nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, if you would call the roll.
Councilmember Perotti.
Here.
Councilmember Bennett.
Here.
Councilmember Seves.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tempore Vallejo.
Here.
Mayor Farr.
Here. All right. Now, let's see. We have one comment to be given to us in public forum. It would be Richard Foster. If you'd like to come up, Richard, and make your comment.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Sorry to look quite so grubby. My suit was at the dry cleaners. I was just running late. Just a couple of things noticed around town. Old Town, we don't need to really revitalize it too much. Go spend some time there. A lot of people walk that area at night and stuff. I'm really afraid we're going to start a revitalization campaign that eventually drives people out of the neighborhood. First year thing what will happen is some developer will buy the Michelle Apartments and put in granite and stainless, jack the rent sky high, and that'll be the beginning of the end for working class families in Goleta, which may be the goal, I don't know. Secondly, parking, and I don't know if this comes up under the new zoning plan because I didn't pay attention to that, but we really need to have more parking as part of our planning. I know that over here at John Price's new project, I swear to God, they'll be spilling on the street. Unfortunately for that parcel, there's not much street to spill out onto. If you go up to the new Westar project, the only place open right now is Smart and Final. Their parking lot's already full most of the time during the day without any of those other stores being open. I think there's an inherent problem of not requiring sufficient parking for the realities of our developments. You know, two-bedroom apartments have at least two people in it, seems all the time, with two cars. So I would say the planning or whoever is responsible should look at raising the requirements for future developments if we ever have any. Which brings us to planning. I think we're close to build out here after Tobes' Willow Springs 3. Now might be the time to start looking at cutting down on our planning staff down to the realistic levels one might need if you're not doing big projects anymore. Eliminate a few positions, and that money would be freed up for other things, such as our library, which is, if you've been to the library, that place is packed all the time. It's a great community resource. If there's a place to cut, instead of taking stuff away from planning, the planning commission and giving it to staff, I'd say put it on the planning commission, start looking at savings, because long term, I don't think we're going to need as many positions if we have, and we can use it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you covered a lot of ground there. So I think that's it on public forum. If anybody has anything they would like to say about something other than what we will be talking about today. No, okay, that brings us to our city manager. Are there any amendments or adjustments to the agenda?
We have no amendments or adjustments.
All right, now we go with the consent calendar, Madam Clerk.
Item A1, approval of the City Council meeting minutes of February 2nd, 2016. A2, acceptance of the January 2016 check register. A3, acceptance of quarterly treasurer's report for quarter ending December 31st, 2015. A4, adoption of water efficient landscape ordinance to conduct the second reading by title only and waive further reading and adopt ordinance number 16-next in order entitled an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, establishing a water efficient landscape ordinance. A5, copier lease agreement. A6, Stork Road US 101 southbound ramps, traffic signal and lining installation, project plans and specifications. A7, marijuana delivery regulation fees and amendment to bail schedule. To adopt resolution number 16-next in order entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, establishing fees for marijuana delivery service licenses and marijuana delivery driver licenses. B, adopt resolution number 16-next in order entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, amending the bail schedule to add violations of chapters 5.09 marijuana delivery and 8.16 marijuana cultivation of the Goleta Municipal Code. A8, amendment number 1 to an agreement for new zoning ordinance and local coastal program services with RRM Design Group.
All right. Before I ask any council members if they would wish to pull something here. We have a request from Barbara Massey to speak on item A8. Ms. Massey, if you would.
Good afternoon and thank you. The proposed scope of work doesn't indicate any plan to have meetings to explain the zoning ordinance to the community, which has repeatedly been requested. The open houses are slightly useful to those of us who read the ordinance and have questions, but nothing is there to inform. Most of Goleta citizens don't even know there's a draft zoning ordinance available for review. Funds should be allocated for several public meetings that would explain what is being proposed in the new ordinance, how it differs from the current ordinance, and allow sufficient time for public questions and discussion. These meetings should be well publicized and notices mailed to every homeowner. The ordinance should then be changed to fit the community. Preparing a draft EIR at this time is just ridiculous. The scope of work should be rewritten to include public meetings requested by both citizens and professional planners, and failure to hold such meetings would indicate to the public that you don't care what they want. This entire zoning ordinance process has been a complete and utter mess. The council has done nothing about the many complaints. You aren't representing your citizens at all. I'm very upset about what's happening to the city of Goleta.
All right, thank you, Ms. Massey. All right, do I have a motion to, let's see, are there any that the council members would like to pull off our?
I would like to pull A8.
Okay, is there a second on that? Do we need a second on that? We don't need a second. Okay, A8 is off the table. Let's do A through 7. Is there a?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, so A7, A1 through A7 is approved, which leads us to A8. Would you like to
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. We all received a letter from Dr. Inga Cox last night with several questions that I think is worth addressing and having staff answer if they can. But before I saw this letter, I did myself have some questions. And one of the questions that I would like to address is that it looks like this is taking longer. The process for the zoning ordinance is taking longer than had been anticipated. And I'm wondering if that's due in part by not having a reference, a comparison. I know that that's been brought up very, very often. In the very beginning, the workshops discussed that there would be some kind of a comparison. And I want to thank Jennifer Carmen for spending time with me the other day to help me try and navigate. But I'm having a heck of a time figuring it out. I can only imagine others are as well, and that it's taking longer for the Planning Commission to go through it. And they're doing an excellent job. They're asking incredibly wonderful questions. But I'm wondering if we might that's my first question. It's taking longer because it's a little bit more difficult to understand and read.
Actually, this process, the lengthy time that I think where the process has lengthened was the creation of the comparison document. That took about a year. That is a large matrix that goes through the existing code and then shows exactly what's proposed in the new code. That's out. We've sat down with a number of different residents and community groups and businesses to talk about how to go through the ordinance. And they've all been very pleased. There is a phone number on our website. They can call us, just like we sat down and went through everything. And that was the longest period of time from the modules to where the public review draft was available. And so that document is still out and available. It's for free at our counters and on the website.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you don't feel that this extending the contract at this point, it has anything to do with it taking longer we're planning at this point to navigate through.
Actually, no. The original amount that council allotted for this project, we had spent a certain amount, and then at budget time, they put the remainder back into the general fund. All this contract amendment does is bring that money, the rest of that money back that was originally allocated for this project. It's not about time. It's about having the consultant be able to finish.
Okay. And then...
And we are not privy to the letter that Inga sent, so I don't know what is in it, actually. I don't believe city manager does either.
Yeah, I wasn't copied on that, I don't have it, and the clerk doesn't have it.
I am so sorry. Usually I'm so good about forwarding on. That's unfortunate you don't have it in front of you. I know we don't like that, so I apologize. Some of her questions were about the funding for renewing the contract. She was confused on how the numbers came up to. It says, according to fiscal impact, $815,000 was approved for the zoning ordinance project budget. And then we also received $125,000 from the Coastal Commission. And... $753,345 have been spent from the general fund, and $815,000 was approved. You have $61,655 left over. That same goes for the Coastal Commission grant, $125,000 minus. You know, these are numbers that you probably have to have in front of you to really understand what she's saying.
They're the numbers in the staff report that we're aware of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then she's saying that there's $60,000 left over. So if you add the two leftover sums, you end up with $121,904 still to be spent.
And that's what the contract amendment is for.
Okay. Because she's saying this is almost the same sum requested by amendment number one under the second whereas to provide for additional compensation in the amount of $121,900.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So that was one question she had. And the question I had, too, and she brings up the general plan changes.
There are no general plan changes proposed with this ordinance.
Okay. But the reason it's put into the contract is in case that there are general plan changes.
It would be part of the LCP, our local coastal program. That is, those policies in that are the only general plan elements that would be considered by council. It's not actually due to the zoning ordinance as part of our coastal update.
Okay, and if there needs to be any general plan amendments, that would be done after the zoning is complete.
The LCP actually, we will come through with the zoning ordinance adoption long before the LCP is actually ready for your review, because Coastal Commission takes a lot of time with that before the city has an opportunity to actually look at that.
Okay. Then on big page 8, she referenced that, why is staff assuming that 100 comment letters with no more than 300 total comments will be received, and that's under the scope, I guess, of work. I'm assuming that means you're anticipating no more than 300, but you wouldn't cap it at 300.
Not at all. That's a standard assumption for the EIR.
Okay.
Of our projects.
And then she wanted to also know who would be participating in the 10 interested party meetings. Are those developers, or can the public have...
That is the phone number that's on our website, okay. And we've already had several with the League of Women Voters, the Chamber of Commerce, random citizens who have called. We've invited a lot of the citizens, including Inga and Barbara, to call that number and set up a meeting, and we'll sit down with them and walk them through the zoning ordinance. Because I think there's a lot of confusion and a general... some misinformation that's been out in the public, and not a full, thorough knowledge of our existing code, which means looking at our new code is even more difficult.
Well, I know I'm having a difficult time with it, so I definitely am. And I think I mentioned to you, is there any possibility of doing examples at some point, like a development that we have now versus how it would be different under the new zoning? Is that a possibility?
We've discussed that, and we could certainly talk about that. It's illustration material that we would give to the Planning Commission and then to the council. But I think at this point, some of the misinformation that's being promoted through the public, we're looking at dealing with those informational aspects differently. and matrices showing, for example, the zoning administrator functions, how they're treated now, what power the zoning administrator and planning director has, and what they have in the future, or what they're proposed to have in the future. And I think sitting down with people, it's been very successful. The League of Women Voters, I think, took a lot of away from our meeting, and they understand the ordinance quite a bit better now. So as we put those materials out in the public, I believe it'll do the same.
Right. I think that was the other question I asked you, is if you could do a comparison of the authority under the new existing that the zoning administrator has versus what we have now versus
right.
the new.
And we do have a draft chart. We're going over it to make
Great.
Sure it's done.
Okay. Well, I just also want to thank the Planning Commission. They're doing a fantastic job at going through it page by page, and it's been helping me a
well,
lot.
Well, and just so the community and council understands, a page turned by the Planning Commission is very common. Usually, you know, in my past lives when I've done zoning ordinances, we've done them on Saturdays all day for a certain amount of time, but the commission does do the page turn. And I know a lot of other neighborhood groups and organizations are doing the same thing. So maybe even on Monday night with the Planning Commission when they do it, so everyone can go through it together.
And then after all their comments have been received, what's the process moving forward?
We come back to the Planning Commission and go through, again, on a more efficient basis of dealing with comments and looking at issues as they come up. Okay. So the idea is to bring in a completed document with the... I guess the more controversial policy questions and issues to you for decision making at a time, hopefully in early summer, late spring, depending on when we get there.
Right. Well, so. I know I don't think council's rushing anything. I think we're all really pleased mm-hmm. that everybody's doing a good job, really, and I appreciate the public taking time to look at it as well.
Thank you. You know, in fairness to staff, I didn't send the copy of the email either. I assume they received it. I got the email that Dr. Cox sent us.
You didn't get it?
What
I'm sorry,
said was I did not forward it to staff. I did receive it, but I didn't forward to staff. I assume that they received it. So it's unfair to bring all these questions out for them without having them. I had a chance to vet it. Ms. Carmen, again, remind the public how to provide input on the process.
There is, on GaletaZoning.com, that is the city's zoning website, there is a phone number to call to set up a public meeting or a meeting with staff to go through any questions that you may have on the ordinance. There are also opportunities and emails to comment. If you just want to send an individual comment in on certain aspects of the ordinance. We do know that it is working because the group who's very concerned about RV parking has utilized it. So we have hundreds of comments from them. Mm-hmm. We are usually within 24 to 48 hours of calling the number, we have a meeting set. We have spent in the last few weeks, I would say, between 12 and 15 hours sitting down with different interested parties to discuss the ordinance. And everyone's gone away happy, at least apparently. It seems like they have, and they understand it much further. And we do offer more than one meeting. They're free. We do not charge. It is all staff time okay. that we put forward on this.
We're able to get a good temperature reading by the amount of emails we receive. And the only email that I've been receiving, other than this one last night, had to do with the mobile home
right.
the RVs.
Right.
So on your website, and I admit I haven't visited lately, is there an FAQ portion of it so that those who are asking the questions may have already been asked and answered instead mm-hmm. of having to take up council time readdressing issues that have been already covered by staff a number of times?
We did do an initial sort of coverage of what the ordinance is, but we could definitely look at adding to or creating an FAQ that would do that.
Thank you. Those are my questions. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I just want to comment again that I apologize. I thought you had this letter. Next time I'll look more closely
Thank
and make
you.
Sure it does go to you, and I will forward it to you.
Thank you very much.
I already did.
Oh, thank you.
Did I understand you to say that the amendment is, in fact, a rededication of monies that have been approved earlier?
Yes. The council originally, we had talked about a certain number in early 2013 to move forward with the ordinance. We reduced that slightly based on general budget discussions. And then in 2014-15, That entire amount that was left over was put back into the general fund, knowing that we would need an additional appropriation in the future. And that's what we're here to do today.
And that's part of a general plan. I shouldn't use that term lightly in this discussion. A general idea that Ms. Wilson has come up with, where we should keep those funds in the general fund until we're sure we're going to use them at that point in time.
Right, so, and that was discussed during the budget discussions.
So this is really just reallocating the money we've originally. It's not because the program's costing any more or anything like that. It's just getting the money back. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that across the board in all city functions at this point. So with that said, I'd like to move that we approve this additional authorization, unless there's any other questions.
Second.
Go.
All right.
You did it.
I did.
And I seconded that. Okay, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Carmen, Ms. Wells, and thank you for the whole department. Your professionalism and your transparency on this will serve us well as we get closer to the actual combat.
Thank you very much.
If, in fact, there is combat. All right. Now, I guess we're over to our Madam Clerk.
Item B1, Southern California Gas Company's La Goleta Storage Facility.
All right. Now, who is going to address this? You're going to tell us what they're doing, and then we'll give them the third degree?
Something like that.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mayor and City Council. As you know, Southern California Gas Company, SoCalGas, Semper Utility, operates the existing La Goleta facility and an underground natural storage reservoir. The facility is located in the unincorporated portion of the county adjacent to the city between the Rancho Goleta Mobile Home Park and the ocean. They're on Moore Mesa, the facility itself. The underground reservoir is located to the west, and that's generally under Goleta Slough. In light of the Los Angeles Porter Ranch area methane leak from the Aliso Canyon Natural Gas Storage Facility, staffs received public and city council comments and concerns about the facility here locally and the enhancement project. The questions are generally about the number of wells and the locations of the new wells, the safety of the facility and the project, and also the planned future of the facility. These are some of the example questions that we've been asked. So in response to your inquiries, staff has an informational slide presentation so you can better understand the facility and the resources in our area. The presentation will be supported by Mr. Mahoney, Mr. Lefevre, and their staff. So they brought their team here so that ensure that we can get your questions answered. Also included in the PowerPoint is a slide of map and the facility of the broader region as opposed to the smaller map that was in your staff report. That way Mr. Mahoney or Mr. Lefevre can show you where the facilities are that they have, where the exactly-ish the basin is, and also their properties in the region. And so with that short introduction, I'm just going to turn it right over to the SoCalGas team to go through the presentation so you can ask them your questions.
I admire your courage to be coming so close to Porter Ranch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council, members of the public. Tim Mahoney, I'm public affairs manager with Southern California Gas Company, and here with me today, Ed Wigman, Glenn Lefevers, Tony Tartaglia. They're all going to be part of the presentation here so that we can fully address all of your concerns. I thought I would just kind of come up and set the table, if you will, and then other members will introduce themselves and we can move forward through the presentation. So I came to Santa Barbara in 1972. I've been with Santa Barbara, the Southern California Gas Company, rather, for about pushing 18 years. Great company to work for. I'm a graduate of Santa Barbara City College and a graduate of UCSB. I have two children that graduated from Goleta, Dos Pueblos High, so I'm pretty well versed on what takes place locally here, and I'm very, very proud of our community, and thanks to a lot of folks for showing up today. I recognize several people in the audience. Let me just kind of tell you who the gas company is and kind of how we operate. So when you go to cook something and you turn your stove on and that pilot light lights up and you get that flame burning, that's us. Last couple of days, you probably haven't had a chance to flip on the thermostat because it's been too warm. Go back November, December, when it was a little bit cold. You wake up in the morning, you go to that wall, and you flip on that thermostat, and all of a sudden that hot air comes out to heat the space, heat your homes from the furnace. That furnace is probably running on natural gas. Swimming pools, hot tubs, jacuzzis, all of that function is probably heated by clean, burning, efficient natural gas coming to your house and my house, and we're the owners of that gas, and you're our customers. In this area, big customers are, UCSB, of course. Commercially speaking, the greenhouses, carpinteria, nurseries, people like that. You go up north. One of our last installations up the coast is we have natural gas buses at Hearst Castle. That was a project we did about 15 years ago. We take visitors from the visitor center up to the castle, and that operates on a natural gas bus. Prior to us coming, it was diesel, and it was a hot spot. So we were able to work with the locals and the gas company. We got a new line up there. That's the last customer on the coast, if you will. We're at the northern end of the gas service territory. You go up, our last big customer is also Camp Roberts, San Luis Obispo. The big pipes, I'm not talking about our distribution coming into homes, the bigger pipes then go over into the San Joaquin Valley. We service Tulare County, Kings County, Bakersfield. It sweeps down the valley, up and down the Grapevine, into the greater Los Angeles area, Ventura, the Inland Empire, San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange County. That's kind of the big picture of the service territory. 6+ million meters, 20+ million people. So in order to take the gas to those commercial, industrial, and institution customers, we have a storage facility in different parts of the area, as well as pipeline, in order to make all that function. And you'll hear more about that as we go. I want to say that the Goleta facility, and you'll hear more of this in particular, but we have done a very good job, and I'm very proud of this, as an outreach facility. We have talked to all of our neighbors. Once a year, we go out to first responders. That would be the police, the fire, UCSBs, people like that, and we invite them over, and we give them a natural gas training. Today, right now at 1:30, there's a natural gas first responder training going on in the Carpinteria Summerlin Fire District at station number one. So that's we do that all throughout the service territory, but in Goleta Storage, we've been particularly a good job of that. We also have gotten 2 awards at the Goleta Storage Facility for excellence in operation. We have contacted our good neighbors at the Rancho Goleta Mobile Home Park several times and had presentations there, given them a tour. We've reached out several times, and let me just jump back in history. This is a document that you and I have all seen. As a matter of fact, the last time I was here giving a presentation, I believe it was on the storage enhancement program, and this is the giant EIR that we did. So at that time, we also reached out. This was a county planning commission, county board of supervisors approval. But through this process, we really became much more transparent. Now, this was just focused on 4 wells, 2 of which have been drilled, and you'll hear more about that. But my point is this, that we want to be good neighbors, we want to outreach, and I'm delighted to come here today to be part of all that's going on, and we'll hopefully answer all your questions and, you know, and fulfill whatever communication links are there. So I think that's kind of what I have to say now, and I'm going to invite Glenn Lefevers come up to the microphone, and I think Glenn will take us through the slideshow.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us here. My name is Glenn Lefevers. I'm a storage operations manager for Southern California Gas Company. Very happy to be here today to address you. A little bit about my background. Been with the Sempra Energy family of companies a little over 32 years. Started my career here along the coast. I've spent about half of that career with Southern California Gas Company, about 10 years in the storage operations group, which is what we're going to talk about today, what we do in storage operations, and a number of years at the beautiful La Galita storage facility here in Santa Barbara. I'm proud to be a graduate of UC Santa Barbara, and also very proud to be a lifetime resident of the city of Carpinteria. So enjoy our lifestyle here on the coast. Today I want to go through this slide presentation with you. I promise you I won't go through it line by line. We'll kind of skip around a little bit, and want to give you an overview of what we do in storage operations, what our business is, how we contribute to the energy infrastructure and supply for our service territory, which is really all of Southern California, as Tim pointed out. You can see on the slide that's up before you, our service territory is close to half the state of California. It comes from the border all the way up through the Central Valley to the Fresno area and over to the coast. You can also see some statistics there about our customers and our capacity of storage. I want to talk to you a little bit about that as we go through the presentation. So if you could skip to the next slide, please. Very quickly, our customer base split pretty evenly. Electric generation is a huge part of our gas system load, followed by commercial, industrial, and then residential. So about 75% of our load goes to those three categories of energy demand and supply. Next slide, please. So let's talk about the natural gas energy that we use here in Southern California. About 90% of the gas that we consume, a little bit more actually, is imported from out of state, from the Midwest, Rocky Mountain areas, South Central states, and a very small portion is produced locally. There is some local production here in this area, but again, most of the gas comes from out of state. We transport it across the border and into California, and once it's into California, it comes through SoCal Gas Pipelines down into our service territory. Next slide, please. So let's talk specifically about the storage fields. I know that's what you're interested in talking about, and specifically about the La Galita storage field. This map is a depiction of our service territory and the pipeline systems that feed us. Along the right-hand side of the map represents our border. There's several very large pipelines that bring gas from the border down into the central area of our service territory. We have four operating underground storage fields. We're here today to talk to you about the La Galita field that's shown here on the map along the coast. The Aliso Canyon field is located in the San Fernando Valley on the northern end near Porter Ranch. That's that location. Ana Rancho is over in the Santa Clarita Valley. And we also have a storage facility, Playa del Rey, which is near the airport in Los Angeles. Size-wise, the Aliso Canyon facility is the largest storage field, followed by Ana Rancho, then La Galita, and then Playa del Rey. So total capacity is about 136 billion cubic feet of natural gas that's stored in these storage fields collectively. And that is, we'll talk next about how we use, why it's important to have storage and how we use that supply of natural gas. So if we go to the next slide, please. So we talked about the delivery of gas into our storage system. I want to talk a little bit about how it's actually stored in the underground formation. This slide, it's not a great depiction, but bottom right corner of the slide, that's a core sample of sandstone rock formation. All of our gas in the storage fields that SoCal Gas operates is stored not in tanks, not in caverns, but in actual sandstone rock formations that are below ground. And this gas fills the pore space in the sandstone formation. So picture a bucket of dry sand at the beach, and we fill it up with water, and the water just absorbs into the sand. It's filling up the pore spaces in the sand, and that's what the gas does at our storage field. So they are excellent storage reservoirs, and typically about 30% pore space in those reservoir capacities. These formations are deep underground. The La Galita facility storage reservoir is around 5,000 feet deep, and the other fields are deeper. Aliso Canyon is in the 8,500-foot range, as is Ana Rancho. So very deep underground, lots of surface rock above the storage reservoirs. There's typically a cap rock on top of the sandstone that prevents any gas from escaping to the surface. Next slide, please. My slide's out of order here. So just real quickly, you know, why do we need the storage fields? Why are they so important to our delivery system? As I mentioned, we import all of our gas in from out of state, and it comes in through pipelines. Those pipelines have a limited delivery capacity to bring gas into the state. The storage fields serve as a balancing mechanism for both supply as well as to balance the price of gas. So as gas is readily available when demand is low and prices are low, that gas is transported into California and placed into storage in our storage fields. That's typically during the shoulder months in the early summer and early fall. That's when we inject gas into the ground. That's when demand is low. Once we have gas in storage at these locations, the locations are critical because they're near locations where demand is high. So once we have the gas in storage, it's available for use during peak periods. And those peak periods occur in the winter months for heating. So this time of year, you wouldn't know it this last week, as beautiful as the weather is, but this time of year when it's cold, we take the gas out of the ground for heating purposes. And also during the summer, there's a very high peak demand during late summer when it gets very hot, and that's to supply the electric generation load primarily for space cooling, air conditioning, and such. That demand has increased during those summer peak periods in the last 4 or 5 years with the proliferation of renewable energy, particularly solar. So the solar farms that are providing much of the power that's used in California now during the summer months are only producing active power during the heat of the day, when the sun's up and high. As the sun goes down in the late afternoon and into the evening, it's still very, very hot in California and in our service territory. And people are coming home from work, turning on their air conditioners. And so you have this huge peak demand late in the day during the summer. And there is not enough capacity on the pipelines coming into the state to be able to supply those peak demands, as well as the gas moves much too slowly through those pipelines to reach the customers quickly enough. So the storage fields come online. They meet that peak demand, keep the electric generation power plants online, keep our residential and small commercial restaurants and all of those businesses, as well as our industrial businesses, online with clean power during those periods. So that's that's why storage is so important. It also is critical to managing the cost of natural gas. I think all of us appreciate opening our gas bills, and typically one of the lowest utility bills we see, and that's by design of the system. The system is very efficient. These storage fields allow us to purchase and store gas very economically when prices are low, and then we can provide it to customers during those high demand peak periods without having to pay high prices that are typical during high demand periods. Next slide, please. Talk briefly about our regulatory framework and our maintenance and compliance program. So our primary regulator for storage wells is Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources. They regulate everything from the wellhead down into the reservoir. And then the Public Utilities Commission regulates our business as a whole, as well as the storage operations in general. Regular maintenance on wells themselves include daily observations, weekly pressure monitoring, if not more frequently, monthly wellhead inspections, and then at a minimum, annual internal inspections of every operating well. So that's kind of the standard template for well maintenance at our storage fields. We're also regulated by the Air Resources Board, as well as in this area, Santa Barbara County APCD. So lots of regulatory oversight. I'm going to let Ed talk about the storage enhancement project. I know that Tim mentioned earlier, and I'm also going to let Ed speak about the La Galita facility in particular. Ed is our storage operations manager for the La Galita storage facility. If you could just slip to that next slide, which I think should be the map. And so I'll let Ed point out the location of the facility. You can see here the outlined area on the map is the primary location of the compressor station, as well as a number of wells for the facility. And the reservoir itself extends in a broader area, as was mentioned earlier, underneath the slough, and in this area is where the reservoir itself is located. SoCal Gas owns close to 300 acres in this area that makes up the storage field. That concludes my presentation. I hope it was brief enough for you. Again, I'm going to let Ed talk to you about specifics about La Galita. I am happy to answer any additional questions that you have that I can help with following Ed's presentation as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Glenn. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, council members. I'm Ed Wigman. I'm the manager of the La Galita Natural Gas Storage Field. I have 27 years with Southern California Gas Company, and I've been the manager of the La Galita field for the last 3 years. And prior to me, it was Mr. Glenn Lefevers was the manager. A lot of the information that I was going to cover is in the staff report that Ann put together, but I just wanted to give a quick rundown of our facility before we go into the questions that the council provided ahead of time. Like Glenn pointed out, the facility is right here. Access is via Patterson down Moore Ranch Road. Our front gate is there. We also have facilities right there by the airport and three wells over by the east gate of the college of UCSB. Gas was discovered in our field in 1929. Oil companies were looking for oil. All they found was gas. They didn't really want gas, but that's what they found. They produced that gas, and the field was converted to a storage operation in 1941. When gas was discovered there, the discovery pressure was about 2,035 PSI. That's what nature held there in that formation for however many millions of years it did. We operated at a maximum of 1,861 pounds, so we know nature proved it out, and we're running it at a lower pressure. The average depth to our reservoir is 4,200 feet. We can inject gas into our reservoir at a rate of 127 million cubic feet per day, and we can withdraw on a cold day up to 420 million cubic feet of gas. In total, we can store 21.5 billion cubic feet of gas at the La Galita Natural Gas Storage Field. We have 22 wells now. 19 of those are injection and withdrawal wells. Two are observation wells where we just monitor pressure. And the last well is one of our new native gas wells. When we're on injection, we inject gas into the ground using large compressors. These are 80-year-old compressors that still run great, and they run clean enough to where we can sell emission credits for extra income. It's a 24-hour, 24/7 operation. We have always at least one operator on site to respond to any issue that we have. We do try to be good neighbors. We have an open dialogue and try to be responsive to our neighbors, Rancho Goleta Estates, as well as our neighbors to the west of us. We have held numerous tours to show people our facility and our operation. We've had UCSB over, Vice Chancellor, and several other people. We've had a state assemblyman from North County, county supervisors, county planning commission, the Office of Emergency Management. As Tim mentioned, first responders come out every year and we show them around, as well as our neighbors. And we had Rancho Goleta over in 2014 to show them our operation. Now, the council provided, thank you very much, you provided a list of questions ahead of time that I'd like to run through now and cover. The first question was, how many cubic feet of gas has been injected into the underlying rock formations? We understood this to mean how much is in there at a maximum. 21.5 billion cubic feet is our maximum. Now, that's the working gas of the field. When we take the field down to our zero working gas, there's still some gas left in the field, and that has to stay there to preserve the formation. There's about 28 billion cubic feet of cushion gas in addition to the working gas. How many wells exist? 22 wells total, like I mentioned. How many new wells have been drilled since receiving permission from the county to go forward? We drilled two wells. The names of those wells are Todd 1 and Todd 2. And Todd 2 is being converted immediately to a storage well. That means it's going to be one of our regular storage wells. That was Todd 1. Todd 2 is going to be our native gas well that we hope to produce native gas out of the field. Do all old and new wells have a working safety valve? All of the operating wells that can inject and withdraw gas have surface safety valves, and these valves will automatically close that wellhead if a problem is detected, either a pressure problem or a fire. We have fusible plugs. Also, if the well is producing sand and particulates that we don't want, it will automatically shut that well in. So that's 19 of the wells. The remaining wells are not connected to any system, and the valves are already shut, so there's no reason to have an automatic closing valve. In addition to that, four of our wells meet the definition of a critical well under DOGGR, the Department of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. And so the three wells near the college site and one of the wells near the sand spit exit have the subsurface safety valve that will automatically close if there's a problem with the well. And that's about 100 feet down below the surface. So if something catastrophic like a plane or a truck took out the wellhead, you still have that valve 100 feet below safe that will shut in the well. How often are the safety valves tested to determine their effectiveness? We test those biannually, twice a year, both the subsurface valves and the surface valves. Have there ever been any blowouts of natural gas from the underground storage area? As long as we've operated that field, there have been no blowouts. Now, there are some historical documents from when the first original two wells were being drilled. When they hit the reservoir, they blew out, as is not uncommon in that day when you were drilling wells. You've seen photographs of the oil spewing out, you know, when they discover oil. So that's what happened back then. How were any blowouts controlled? One was controlled using drilling muds, which is what we would do today, and the other The other one was re-drilled. What is the topside perimeter of the underground gas field? It's about 300 acres, and Glenn talked about the extents of that. How deep is a gas field? Average depth is 4,200 feet. And the geologic zone where the gas is stored is about 300 feet thick. And what pressure is the gas stored at? It's between 1,000 PSI and 1,861 PSI. What is the planned future of the gas field, meaning decommissioned, expanded, stay the same? We plan to continue operating the field. And if the expansion project is successful, that could add 3 to 5 billion cubic feet to our capacity. That's the only plans that we have for expansion right now. What equipment is on site to control a leak at the wellhead if one were to occur? At each injection and withdrawal well, we have the automatic fail-closed surface safety valves that, like I said, would automatically close if it detects a pressure problem or a fire or excessive sand. We also have a remote operating quick closing mechanism located about 100 feet from the wellhead. If there was a problem, you just turn the valve, closes in the wellhead. We also, our wells have what we call kill lines, which are about 100 foot long lines that allow us to pull up a mud truck and pump mud into that well if we had to get control in a catastrophic situation. What equipment is on site to control a leak outside the wellhead? This would be a case-by-case situation, but if we got into an extended situation, we probably would need to bring in equipment from off-site, like a workover rig type thing. That's all I had. Hopefully we haven't taken too long. Would you like to go into Q&A? Do you have any questions?
We always have questions, I'm sure. Councilmember Aceves.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for the tour I took of your facility. I never, in all the years I've lived here, I've never gone out there. I never knew what a huge operation it was, but it was very reassuring seeing the systems you have out there. I think that the question that the community wants to know, and that's why I think that all those questions were leading up to this, is how does this community know that we don't have a Port Arant situation? So if you can explain the differences between the two, gas versus gas and oil, I think the public would like to hear that. The other thing is, on the map that you showed, that's the area, that's the land that you cover, where your operation is. However, you extend into UCSB. Staff said that the reservoir goes underneath the slough. Could you be a little more specific as to where the reservoir is, and does it go under any residential units? If it does, what safety measures do you have in place for those particular lines, if that is the case? And and you know, if there's a shutoff for the residential areas, it's important to know if in fact it goes there. The other thing is, when we took the tour, you talked about earthquake safety. What do we have prepared? Should there be, since we are an earthquake country, if we had an earthquake? And then my final question is, as we this council went through saving Goleta Beach, we were reminded that you have a line that goes out there.
Right.
And it can be exposed. And what are your plans to provide safety for that? I think at our tour, you talked about even the plan of possibly closing down the facility at UCSB, which would eliminate that. So if you can just cover those three areas, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Can I walk over to the screen to just kind of draw the outline of the field real quick?
I think it's still in counter range, or you can have a pointer. I don't know.
Oops, the battery fell out.
I think we'll give you a pointer. That way you stay in camera range.
Oh, the batteries. Sorry.
I think Tim has one.
We got one for you.
Thank Is it the green button? So here's our main plant right there. And the reservoir basically is like an amoeba shape that goes out like this. So it goes under, you know, south of the end of the runways. And the closest to any building would be the college site, what we call the college site. We have three wells over there, and all of those have the subsurface safety valve. And then there's one well at the sand spit exit that's close to the road, and that has the subsurface safety valve. Does that answer the question about the extent of the reservoir?
Yeah, so there's no residential units?
No. Okay. The next question was earthquake safety?
Yes.
We have had earthquakes here. We do have faults in the area. In fact, a fault actually seals off the north side of our zone, so it's part of our operation. And if we have an earthquake, we have our operators respond and go out and check each well to make sure there are no issues at the well. Those are the basic response systems that we have, is to go out and check each well. I think the last earthquake that we had was about a 5.0, and it was near Platform Holly. I think that was in 2013. And our employees went out, checked each well, and there were no issues at all.
So my last two questions have to do with the UCSB site, the pipeline that goes through out to Toledo Beach. And then the final one is, tell us why we're not looking at a poor ranch situation
right.
here
okay.
in Toledo.
We do have a long-range plan or desire to drill a couple of new wells up here on the Mesa and retire the three wells at the UCSB East Gate and the pipeline that runs between them. I don't know when or if that's going to happen, but that is our desire. And that will be prioritized with the rest of the gas company's work, you know, the most important coming first. And so hopefully we can get to that within the next few years. But it probably will take quite a bit of time to permit the retirement of that facility and the pipeline. So could be 5 years out, could be more. Maybe 10 years. And then just overall, what makes us different than the Porter Ranch situation? We're a much smaller operation. We've never produced oil from this field. It's always been a dry gas field. Some water does come up with the gas, but we don't produce any oil, so that's a big difference. And we have been operating safely without incident for over 70 years. So that's our track record. And, you know, we inspect our wells, you know, periodically, twice a year at least. And we've seen no anomalies in our wells. We have no leaks at all.
Thank you. Do you know the name of Dusty Rhodes? He used to be a plant manager.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, I bought his house years ago.
Oh, okay.
So I want to put that out in the record, a little conflict of interest.
All right, Councilmember Bennett.
Yes, I wonder if I may ask some questions just so I can feel a little more comfortable about what has been presented today. I think the fault you're speaking of is the Moore Ranch fault.
It is.
And I'm glad that you explained the area because I understood it went over to UCSB. So, and I know there's an area behind the wall as you enter the East Gate. And I wasn't sure if those were injection wells or observation wells or whatever. So thank you for explaining that.
Sure.
And just so I better understand, the agencies that inspect your facility and that you have to comply with their regulations are the same agencies that inspect and you must comply with at the Aliso Canyon facility. Is that correct?
Dogger is the same. It's a local office out of Orchid, where those inspectors come from. Mm-hmm. But the County of Santa Barbara, the energy office, comes out and inspects our wells every year. So that's different. I assume it would be Los Angeles County for Aliso Canyon.
Different APCD.
It is a different APCD as well. They're under South Coast Air Quality Management District. We're under Santa Barbara County APCD.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate sure. that. But in any case, their emphasis is on safety and making certain that everything is meeting all the regulations that all underground facilities must meet.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, the Aliso Canyon facility, as I understand it, was inspected just as you've described for your La Galita facility. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Yet, in spite of all those inspections and what was done, we've had a catastrophic event that occurred. Is that correct?
There was a leak, yes. Correct.
I would call it catastrophic at this stage of the game.
Okay.
And that leak occurred well below 100 feet.
I think it was about 700 feet.
And that's because, if I understand all the information correctly, that there was a leak not only in the pipe, but there was a leak in the casing itself, which allowed the natural gas to migrate through the so-called cap rock formation.
That leak, I believe, would be above the cap rock formation.
Okay, now I obviously misunderstood. I thought you said that the sandstone was down about 4,000 feet and that there was a cap rock formation above that that kept the gas in place so it would not escape. Did I misunderstand that?
Yes, but it's much deeper than 500 feet.
Okay, then please explain to me how the crater, this is the crater that has been described in the media and pictures have now shown, that exists at the site at Aliso's Canyon, and the fear was so great that cables had to be put on the wellhead to keep it in place so there was not a further catastrophic blowout, which would have meant there would have been no control and there would have been free-flowing gas, and most likely the entire storage facility would have been evacuated of gas if that had occurred. Am I correct in that, or am I misunderstanding once again?
You know, I manage Goleta, and I have not been down to Aliso Canyon during this event, so I really can't speak to that.
Well, maybe someone that's on your team can come forward and speak to it, because my understanding is that crater is 25 feet deep, and it blew the ground material into the air, and the fear was great that the wellhead itself was going to launch, and that's the reason for the cables that were put in place to hold it in place and try to maintain of the overall wellhead that went down, I believe, overall about 4,000 feet or 5,000 feet or further to gain access to the storage area of the natural gas.
Let me just back up just a little bit and I'll try to answer your question the best that I can.
Please, thank you.
And again, in Ed's defense, he's here with, you know, to talk about the La Galita field, and so I have some additional information about the our Aliso Canyon field that I hope will be able to answer some of your questions. First of all, with regards to the event, the leak, it is an anomaly, an extremely unusual and unlikely event. However, it has occurred. And at this point, we don't have all the answers as to why it occurred, we are in the process of stopping the leak. As you know, the leak has been stopped, and it's now being cemented and will be certified as closed. There will be an extensive evaluation of the well and an analysis, a root cause analysis of the cause or causes of the leak that occurred. And that root cause analysis is being directed by both the Public Utilities Commission as well as Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources. So we don't know the answers yet to all of the questions. However, we are committed to learning all of those answers. As you probably know, there are a lot of concerned citizens as well as regulators and local, state, federal politicians, agencies who are involved, and all, you know, we all share in the same interest of one, understanding what happened with that well, and two, making sure it never happens again. So there, as you can imagine, there will be, and there is additional regulation currently proposed to address many of those issues. And at this point, you know, I can't answer all of your questions because we really don't know what caused that leak. There is the release of gas from the reservoir did occur, we believe, from a leak in the well, fairly near the surface. And but again, we don't know that exact depth. That will be determined based on the analysis of the root cause analysis performed. We are not able to do any of those analyses until the leak has been stopped and certified as closed. So, you know, that's kind of the stage we're in right now.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the explanation, the best explanation that you can give at this point in time. But one of the concerns, and it's the same, and you mentioned already that gas is accompanied by water, which is incredibly corrosive, but that's also true with oil. And the number of years that this has been in operation is very similar to the number of years the Lissos Canyon facility was in operation. And when you pump oil, you also pump water, a lot of water, typically. And so it's the water that becomes very corrosive, in addition to some of the other chemicals that are associated with the product. And to me, that's the issue. If you're looking at wells that have this type of age factor, it would seem to me the potential, and you'll learn this as you've indicated because you don't know now, what caused the leak and where the break may in fact have been and whether in fact it is a part of the old casing and piping that was existent when they were originally oil wells. So I don't see much different between an oil well and the fact that this has never been used for oil, because the issue of water coming up through there is still the same. And my understanding is that tends to be the most corrosive factor in the production of either gas or oil. And so given the age of these wells, it would seem to me that it would be prudent that we start thinking about redrilling the wells, either capping off the old ones, putting in new ones, as you're doing right now, with the latest technology possible, and in addition, having the metallurgy be such that it may not be attacked by corrosion and we wouldn't have to have this concern in the future. But that's just a statement on my part. The second thing that I would like to bring up, my understanding, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misinformed, in order to do the slant drilling that was necessary in order to cap off the well, the gas company had no access locally to any of that type of equipment. In fact, you had to import that equipment from Texas in order for it to get here, and of course it took time for it to get here, it took time for it to be set up. So it wasn't readily available to address an emergency situation that occurred after the leak started. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, it is. In part, we did not have the equipment on site to address the leak from the well, and that was brought in from the Gulf States, from Louisiana. It did take some time to get there. That was during the initial phases of the attempt to kill the well and stop the leak. The relief well you mentioned, however, is a different operation. That's a drilling rig as opposed to a coiled tubing rig that was used in the first part. And that rig was actually on site at the facility. And however, moving a rig, creating a location to drill a well, a pad, as the term is, and setting up a rig takes a significant amount of time as well. So the rig that was on site was mobilized. A pad was created to locate that rig on. It was mobilized, and drilling of the relief well, which was ultimately successful in stopping the leak, was commenced in very early December.
Okay, so the original rig that you started with, which was unsuccessful, then that's the one that came from Louisiana.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you for that. And I think my last comment would be, I've always appreciated the fact that we have natural gas, not like the East Coast where they deal so much with coal. Gas is much friendlier to our environment and much friendlier to our community overall, and I'm very appreciative of that. And the fact that we generate our electricity using natural gas for almost all of it, and I think that's a wonderful thing as well, and we benefit from that. But there is obviously a downside. I certainly never thought of this in the manner in which this well blowout has occurred at Alisos Canyon. So the impact, as we're beginning to learn, is rather tremendous. So I'm thinking that with all of the great minds that are out there and the scientists who will be reviewing this and the engineers that will be reviewing this, that we'll come up with a plan. And I've been led to believe the four fields that you previously described, the Honor, the Playa del Rey, and La Galita, will all be required to be meeting new standards and new requirements in the future as we go forward, as we learn more about what this is all about. So I appreciate your cooperation. I appreciate the outreach that you've already done and certainly endeavored to make people as whole as they can possibly be down in Porter Ranch by supplying housing, et cetera, but you can see how upset the community has been. And again, it was never in anyone's mind that that was going to occur. And certainly I'm sure it wasn't in your minds that it was going to occur. So it's something new for all of us. But because we now have experienced that, I would hope that the due diligence for La Galita will go forward and that you will be a leader in doing that to make this as humanly safe as is possible with all the new information that is going to be obtained over the next 6 months or so. So thank you. I appreciate your answer to my questions.
Thank you.
Not right now, but do we have public comment?
I'm sorry.
I just think we have public comment. I was just trying to...
No, I think we've pretty much covered this. Did anybody want to weigh in on this? Okay, have you filled out a speaker slip? That's, we kind of demand that of you.
They do it afterwards.
I missed that. We thought it was for the first part of it. We didn't know it was this part, but you had to fill
it. She can fill it out afterwards. She can do it afterwards.
Just have to do it. Okay, why don't you fill it out now?
Well, no, why don't you let her do it after? Let her speak now, and then she can fill it out after.
Oh, okay, if you would, if you'd like to.
Just put your name on the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me have one small question. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Bennett, because your concerns are our concerns. My name is Maureen Shields. I'm president of the board of directors of La Galita Lakeside Mobile Home Park. I'm a little nervous. I've never spoke before you before. Please be patient. I have only one, I'm agreeing with Mr. Bennett that the leak was below surface. A shut-off valve at the top wouldn't do any good, to my understanding. And my question is, how are these wells inspected? Are there cameras put in the pipes? Is there pressure? How do you inspect these wells, especially these old wells? That's my main question. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Twice a year, we do what's called a temperature survey on the wells, and we run a temperature probe from top to bottom on that well, and we record the temperatures. And if there was a leak, it would show up as a cold spot on that survey. And all of our wells, the last survey was in November. Everything was perfect. Everything was clear. In addition to that, we do what's called a bar hole survey, where we go around the surface of the well in the soil, and we inspect. We look for gas, any gas coming up out of the surface, which would be similar to this Aliso Canyon leak. We do that quarterly, and those always come out perfectly clean.
There are a lot of natural leaks.
There is a lot of natural, shallow surface gas that comes out, yes. And we do inspect that, and we can run a lab analysis of that and fingerprint it to make sure it's not our gas.
Well, the concern is it took so long for you to do what you had to do at Aliso Canyon. I mean, that would be catastrophic for me, where I live, right across the road there.
Understood, and we don't want that to happen here. Believe me, we don't want that to happen here.
Either.
As Glenn mentioned, that was a very unique situation, and in our entire history, we haven't had a failure like that. So I expect we're going to be learning a lot of new things about our wells.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Councilman Perotti.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have a question for you that made me think when you're talking about how do you know if there's a leak. I had gone to a presentation at Lockheed Martin several months ago where they were developing some kind of infrared cameras that can detect gas in the air. Is that something in the future that you'd be looking at? I mean, is that something that you could use?
I expect so. We did just do a survey of all of our wells. It's called a FLIR, mm-hmm. forward-looking infrared. Mm-hmm. We had about a week and a half to do a survey of our field and all of our wells. The CPC asked us to do this survey just to give everything a once-over. And we hired a company to bring in those FLIR cameras mm-hmm. and inspect each wellhead to make sure that they weren't leaking. And I would expect that we're probably going to adopt that technology, but we'll see once the investigation is complete.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right. If you would hold there for a second, Mr. Wigman. Anybody else have a question or comment?
I would just say I appreciate Mr. Mahoney reaching out to us immediately after kind of the Porter Ranch thing came to public knowledge, and then I was also at a tour that Ed, I'm sorry, I'm not going to try and say your last name, Ed. But
Wigman.
Thank you. Yes. That's not too hard to say, is it? That Mr. Wigman gave, and I have to tell you, I was very impressed with his knowledge, and he seemed to have an answer for every question we threw at him. And I'm glad you guys are coming forward and being proactive about this. It would be very troubling if you weren't doing this, you know, trying to bury your head in the sand about this. I appreciate the fact that you're keeping in touch with your neighbors there and making sure they understand what you're trying to do. And, of course, we're going to encourage you to keep doing that and keep us safe. So.
All right. Yeah, let me extend my appreciation to you folks, too. The Times had a field day with this, of course. I mean, it must have been on the front page six or a dozen times for sure.
Right.
And if I recall, some of the things that they said was that the safety valve that wasn't, in fact, there was down 1,000 feet. And in 1979, it was removed, the safety valve, and for reasons I don't understand. I mean, it seemed like a good idea to replace it, but somebody decided not to replace it, and had that been in place, we wouldn't be having this discussion about Aliso Canyon. But I think the thing about that the Times reported is ultimately this is going to cost the company billions of dollars, and I'm sure that's our best guarantee that you guys will make sure that it never happens again, because it's catastrophic for you guys. So I have confidence in that. Do SoCalGas invest in solar?
Tim, do you know that? Okay. Solar farms, or can you speak more to that? I'm not sure.
Hi, Tim Mahoney back. Mr. Mayor, to answer your question, we do have a solar thermal water heating project that we do. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Well, kind of, sort of, but what I was wondering, I guess, a little more specifically is you mentioned... One of you folks mentioned that there is a something that the gas company has to accommodate now is the solar industry as it grows. And I just wondered if you were going to be moving any assets into that to capitalize on it. So from my perspective, then you become one of the promoters of it and not somebody opposed to it, as it were.
Well, our sister utility is San Diego Gas and Electric. They are owned by Sempra. The same company that we're owned with. The stock is traded on the New York Stock Exchange under Sempra Energy SRE. So in that sense, you know, yes, we are. I believe what you're referring to was when Mr. Lefevers was here explaining that there's a large air conditioning load in the summertime that requires an abundance of electrical power, obviously, for the air conditioning load. When the solar farms are working to their high point, it's right in the middle of the day. But then when people come home from work and they flip the home air conditioning on, it's the natural gas that goes into the electrical generating facility because the solar farms have tapered off because the sun is going down. I believe that's the relationship there.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, has the one more final one, if I might. The Governor Brown now and the legislature has pushed in a lot of new regulations on beds like this, on storage facilities like this, and probably other things in the oil business, particularly after Plains All-American. But is what the state will now be demanding of you folks, is that a complication for what you're doing?
I guess we're going to have a joint answer on that. Maybe Glenn can better Mr. LeFevers and Mr. Wigman, since they are day-to-day operators in the storage field, are probably more equipped to answer that than I am. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll do my best to answer your question. We are supportive of the new regulations that are coming down. There's a number of regulations that have been proposed at the state level and various agencies, and we will be participating in the development of that regulation as it comes out, and we do anticipate that it will have a significant impact on our operations as well as operations of other companies that operate in the state of California. So we look forward to working with the regulators on that. I expect that it will be positive with regards to increased safety and reliability of the infrastructure in the state, both for SoCalGas as well as the other operators in the state. So there is a lot coming.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it'll be onerous in some respects, but as you say, if it ultimately means that everybody will be safer, then we're all ahead of the game there. And that's the concern of everybody here. I think, as Council Member Aceve said, we just don't want anything to happen here. You know, you guys run it well. I don't think anybody would dispute that. But it's an old field, some of this stuff going back to 41. And so then there's always a concern about things that have not been done, human error, as it were. So I appreciate Tim reaching out to us, as Council Member Vallejo said, and you coming, Mr. LeFevers and Mr. Wigman. Thank you for that. And I'm going to sleep better. I'm sure if it blew up, I would have a problem. I'm just kidding, by the way. I know it's not. Okay, anybody else want to get a final?
I got one more question.
Council Member Aceve.
I do want to thank you for coming, bringing your team down here. The information to the public is critical. This is playing live. It'll replay again and again. People may have questions. Who do you want to direct them to? To you, Tim, or who gets the question? Or give them a phone number, website, or something?
Yeah, please contact Tim Mahoney. And
and how do you get a hold of Tim Mahoney? And, Tim, I got to say I like your hair. I'm jealous.
Thank you. Okay, so Tim Mahoney, my office is in Santa Barbara, 134 East Victoria Street. Phone number is 805-681-7930. You can reach me there. I do have a website, not a website, pardon me, a web address, an email, tmahoney@semprautilities.com. So I want to stay readily and available to all of our citizens here. I will make my information available to the city, and if you get people calling in from the city clerk, you should have a stack of my business cards or some vehicle by which you can get a hold of me. We're here constantly. We have my office. We have a base in Santa Barbara as well, in addition to the storage field in Goleta. So we're pretty visible.
All right.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, good. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim, for coming, and thank you, Mr. LeFevers, Mr. Wigman, for coming and reassuring us, I guess. I feel reassured, and we have every confidence that everybody will be redoubling their efforts to see that nothing ever happens like this again. So thank you for coming, and thanks, as Tony said, thanks for reaching out to us.
Thank you. Thank you. Sure, right?
We are going to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll hit it again. Pretty important. lost our audience. Should we just skip what's left and go home? Clerk, would you give us a hand here?
Item B2, Goleta Library Special Tax Ballot Measure Update and General Fund Contribution.
Oh, we lost our... There it is. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. I'll try not to jiggle the wire so we don't lose the PowerPoint. The item before you today is an update on the Goleta Valley Library and related activity following the Council's November 17th, 2015 meeting. I would like to recognize Heidi Atten, our Senior Management Analyst, who has worked very hard on this project. She was here a moment ago, and she may step back in to help answer questions at the end of the presentation. And also our Supervising Librarian, Allison Gray, is here. She oversees the Goleta Library and will also be available to answer any questions. We've updated the staff report for you today to reflect additional revenue from the county, which I'll point out during our presentation. But the charts have been updated in the staff report that was passed out and left on the dais for you prior to the council meeting. As a brief recap, during the November meeting, the City Council directed that a letter be sent to the County Board of Supervisors requesting consideration of a concurrent ballot measure to implement a supplemental parcel tax for the county's service area 3 and the city of Goleta, both of which comprise the Measure L taxation area. And if passed, the supplemental income would address a significant shortfall in operating revenue that has plagued the Goleta Library for a number of years. By way of background, this slide shows the adopted operating budget for the Goleta Valley Library. And as you can see, the expenditures are outpacing revenues in excess of about $250,000 per year this fiscal year, and that deficit escalates in the out years. Currently, the City of Goleta contributes approximately $10,000 in library development impact fees, and the Friends of the Library contribute $48,000. Neither of these amounts include assistance outside of the library budget from either the Friends, who directly fund programming and other purchases, or the city's expenses towards facilities maintenance, capital repairs, and professional services. I should also note that this current budget is very lean and doesn't include funding for deferred acquisition of book collections, computers, furniture, or any other capital improvements. As shown on the last line above the fund balance reserve deficit, the fund balance of the reserves is reduced each year by the operating budget shortfall. So in fiscal year 18-19, if we have no significant reductions in operating costs or any significant increases in revenue, the reserves run out. So the red number of $187,118 in effect in reality would be zero, but we've left that negative number there to show the order of magnitude in terms of the shortfall. What we've added to this chart that wasn't in our chart previously in the staff report is the increase in per capita funding of $87,620. And the City of Santa Barbara adopted the operating budget for the library based on a per capita of $6.80 that the county contributes to the library operating budget. And after that budget was adopted, they increased funding by a dollar. And so based on the population of the library service area, we've added that $87,620 in. And applied it to the fund balance. And what that in effect does is that it pushes out the operating shortfall in terms of the available fund balance by one fiscal year. So previously, we were projecting that we would run out of reserve funding by 17-18, and now we've pushed it out to 18-19 by that additional per capita funding that the county has provided. And I'll show that on the next slide. So on this slide, we show the estimated population of the library service area and the primary funding sources for the library's operating revenue. The library service area is established by the county and approved by the state. The estimated population within the library service area is approximately 88,000 people, nearly 30,000 of which are Goleta residents. Approximately 23,600 are county residents who reside within the county service area 3. And then 34,000 live in the county unincorporated area outside of CSA Area 3. So you can see on the slide that we have approximately 88,000 people who reside within the library service area, and the percentages of those that live within each of sort of those three areas.
As the council knows, Measure L was passed in 1990 by the residents within County Service Area 3 to implement a special parcel tax to support library operations. And then when the city incorporated, the parcels within the city were removed from CSA 3, but the tax remained. Therefore, approximately 61% of the population served by the library contributes directly to support the library through the Measure L parcel tax. In 15-16, the estimated proceeds from this tax is approximately $431,300. The tax rate is based on land use type, so there are different rates for different types of use, such as single, multifamily, commercial, industrial, agricultural, and vacant. As a point of reference, the current tax rate for Measure L for a single-family home is $22.28. The other main funding source for the library is the contribution by the county on a per capita basis of $7.80 per resident within the library service area. So this chart has also been updated to reflect $7.80 multiplied by the estimated population for each one of those three areas. The 15-16 library budget is prepared by the City of Santa Barbara, and they operate the library on our behalf. They had estimated an original budget of $600,700 for the per capita contribution, and you can see here that we've increased it to approximately $683,000. For several years, the Goleta City Council has discussed the option of placing a special parcel tax on the ballot to provide additional funding for the library. The ballot measure would have been based on the Measure L taxation area, so it would be the City of Goleta and CSA 3, which would require the County Board of Supervisors to support a similar measure. As county staff directed, staff brought this proposal of concurrent ballot measures to the county's Library Advisory Committee, which discussed the concept with some interest. And then in December, at the council's direction, the mayor signed a letter that we forwarded to the Board of Supervisors asking for their support of concurrent ballot measures for the CSA 3 area and the City of Goleta. Each measure would include a provision that both measures would need to pass in order to become effective so that neither the county nor the city residents exclusively bore the burden of additional taxation if one entity did not pass the measure. However, at the December Library Advisory Committee meeting, the committee voted that a countywide measure be pursued rather than one specific to the Goleta Valley Library. At the January meeting, the Library Advisory Committee for the county further refined its recommendation, which is included on this slide. At the January meeting, the Library Advisory Committee is now recommending to the Board of Supervisors that the county pursue a countywide ballot measure, which would include a parcel tax for all of the parcels in the county, including with all the parcels within each city. Their recommendation is that it be a flat tax per parcel, not graduated, or based on land use for simplicity, that the tax, like Measure L, would be in perpetuity with automatic annual adjustments, and that the proceeds should be distributed per capita rather than by parcel based on the population within each of the library service areas. The recommendation is that the tax range be that the tax range from either $18 to $24 a parcel, and that each of the local agencies should make a good faith statement that tax proceeds are supplemental and don't replace any existing funding. There's another Library Advisory Committee meeting tomorrow, and part of the conversation will relate to a new opinion by County Council that indicates that potentially for a countywide ballot measure, all of the cities would need to support a ballot measure within each of the cities in addition to the county supporting a ballot measure countywide. So that'll be part of tomorrow's conversation. This slide is a comparison of the new countywide, proposed countywide ballot measure, which in theory would need to be approved by the county for the unincorporated areas as well as all the cities. Currently, there are about 129,566 parcels in the entire county. And on the left side, you see $18 per parcel, and on the right, $24 per parcel. So at $18 per parcel, the income or the revenue that would be generated by this new tax would be approximately $2.3 million and range upwards to $3.1 million at $24 a parcel. based on the estimated service area of the Goleta Library might receive upwards of $467,000 to $623,000, depending on the tax, based on a parcel tax that is then distributed on a per capita basis. Comparing that to the original concept of a Goleta Valley Library ballot measure for the CSA 3 area in the city of Goleta, we have approximately 16,300 parcels within our within the Measure L taxation area. Using $18 per parcel, that would generate approximately $294,000, and at $24 a parcel, that would generate $392,000 for the Goleta Library. I should note that the number of parcels and the population figures are only estimates for discussion purposes, as they represent a snapshot in time, because these figures do change regularly. The Library Advisory Committee is again considering additional information from county staff at its meeting tomorrow, and county staff has indicated to us that the ballot measure discussion will now not go before the Board of Supervisors until late March or potentially April. They have asked for some feedback that they can provide to the Board of Supervisors about the City of Goleta's opinion with regard to a countywide ballot measure, which is why we have brought this before you today. The staff recommendation is that the City Council support conceptually a countywide library ballot measure subject to review and approval by the Board as well as the City Council if and when language is finalized. A countywide measure provides for a more equitable basis for supporting the library, particularly when one considers that approximately 39% of the library service area does not currently pay the Measure L library tax, nor would they if a Goleta-specific ballot measure for CSA 3 in the city of Goleta were to move forward. In November, to encourage local support of an additional parcel tax and to show its commitment to supporting library operations, the City Council approved in concept providing some level of general fund contribution to the Goleta Library. And then on this slide are the contributions currently made by other cities and the counties to support their local library. The staff recommendation today is for a $30,000 general fund contribution, which has been incorporated into the mid-year budget report that follows this agenda item. The $30,000 would be funded by a current allocation for professional services in the city manager's office to undertake ballot measure polling and retain the services of a financial consultant to estimate potential tax rates. If the county proceeds with a countywide measure, these services would not be necessary. So at the bottom of this slide, if you combine the $30,000 in general fund plus the $10,000 in DIF with the Measure L that is generated in within the city of Goleta, that totals approximately $293,000. And based on the number of residents within the city of Goleta, that's a $9.77 per capita contribution. And you can see how that compares to the other cities. So in terms of next steps, today staff is recommending conceptual support for the countywide ballot measure should the Board of Supervisors just decide to proceed with one. We also have requested that county staff include in its board item a discussion of the pending Goleta request for concurrent measures for the Measure L taxation area so that we have some direction on whether or not any form of ballot measure for our local library might go forward, depending on their discussions, and we'll certainly keep you apprised of that. We are also recommending that the City Council approve a $30,000 general fund contribution to the library, which would be implemented with a budget transfer from the city manager's office to the city's library program budget for distribution to the city of Santa Barbara on behalf of the library. And then finally, at the bottom of the slide here, is the concern associated with how little time is left to develop any ballot measure for the 2016 ballot and to begin a public information campaign on library finances, whether that is for a local ballot measure or a regional ballot measure. And so there may be a need for the Plan B that was discussed during the November meeting. Plan B likely will include a reduction in service levels as our operating budget is already very lean, and most likely include reducing the number of hours that the library is open and potentially reducing the library operating hours by one day per week. So as a point of reference, I've included on the slide the pre-recession operating hours. Previously, the library was open 63 hours per week. Currently, the library is open 55 hours per week. And in order to be able to stay within the operating revenue for the library as it exists today, we would likely have to close the library 8 additional hours or one day per week. So that concludes my presentation. Senior Management Analyst Heidi Atten is back with us, and Allison Gray is with us, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you. That was a very nice presentation. Appreciate that. Okay. Well, I'm sure we have some questions from Council here. I'm sure Council Member Bennett, who is deeply supportive of the library, will have some comments for us.
Well, the only point I would make is that because I sit on the committee, I might just have a little more insight than the rest of the council, along with Councilmember Prati. But I would just say that from what I see, if we want to maintain the library that our community absolutely supports and enjoys, we've got two options. We either support the countywide option, which appears to be the direction the county's going. And if they fail to do that, then we go back to our original fallback position and ask for the County Service Area 3 to go forward. Some of this information has been just recently fleshed out so that we've got a better idea what the service area would contribute, because up to now, other than the county giving the per capita amount based on that service area, with this additional amount, it would be far greater than what we would generate in County Service Area 3. And we would finally have those outside areas that enjoy our library but don't pay for it to begin to contribute to that. And I think that's a real strong impetus for supporting the county's, at least the library committee's proposal at this point. I had some concerns about it to start with, but after having read through it a number of times and paying attention to the potential in the future, I think it's important that people that use the library, in fact, pay for that use. And this is one way for us to get there. And I think from that standpoint, I consider it to be a positive development over what we were originally looking at. But I have no read on the Board of Supervisors as to where their heads are at, mm-hmm. other than their appointed library committee, which is supporting this. So I would hope after we discuss it further that, you know, we can come to a conclusion that we feel comfortable supporting the process.
Council Member Vallejo.
Yeah, do we know why they're waiting until March or April to move on this? I mean, I'm sure we're all concerned about the rush that we're going to have to get through, especially if they say no. Then we're really behind the eight ball.
There have been a number of discussions, and the Library Advisory Committee at its December meeting formed an ad hoc subcommittee to evaluate the effort that would be needed to pursue a ballot measure. I think the city of Goleta has done enough work in recent years to sort of propel this conversation forward. And there was some feedback last fall at the Library Advisory Committee meeting with regard to proceeding with just a Goleta measure versus a countywide measure. And there's a fair amount of enthusiasm among the library advocates on the Library Advisory Committee. So they really are motivated to move forward. But there's a fair amount of information that has to be flushed out with regard to what the ballot measure might look like. And I think that's been the delay, is flushing out what that might be countywide and how that might work.
So if the county were to opt not to go for a countywide measure, how long would it take them to come around and support us on a CSA 3 specific measure, or would they, or how would that work?
Well, in conversations with county staff, we have asked that as they bring this item forward for discussion, that if the primary, and we don't know what the recommendation will be at this point. Right, sure. Now, it's the Library Advisory Committee making a recommendation. It does not, there is no county staff recommendation at this point. So we have asked that when the county staff prepares the board letter item, that they include in that discussion, if they do not support a countywide measure, that they include a discussion on whether or not they will proceed with supporting our pending request for a concurrent measure for...
So we could do it at the same time.
Right, Measure L. So we've asked that that be wrapped into that staff report.
And will we be preparing for that eventuality and so that we're ready to go if the county elects not to?
If the county elects to proceed with just a CSA 3
exactly.
ballot measure, I'm hoping that we'll have a little bit more information after tomorrow's meeting so that we can try and anticipate whether or not we'll need to proceed on our own or whether or not we'll proceed as part of a regional effort.
Okay. I mean, obviously, I think we all agree that we need the funding. I just want to make sure that somehow through the county's late arrival on the scene, and I understand they're trying to make up their mind, too. This isn't an opportunity for me to take another shot at the county in this case, believe it or not. I just want to make sure we're ready to do what we have to do to keep our library functioning at the level it needs to. So, mm-hmm.
Councilmember Perotti.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, I echo everything that Councilmember Bennett just said, being on the ad hoc committee along with Councilmember Bennett. I see it's two different ways. On one hand, when we did meet individually, first with Supervisors Wolf and then with Supervisor Doreen Farr, I can see Supervisor Farr's position on really wanting to help all our libraries because they're all in such need, and she chairs that committee. So I understand where she's coming from. But on the other hand, we've been kind of ready to go and just kind of waiting for the county. And my biggest fear is that this doesn't give us much time. And unless we have that really dedicated group that's going to really go out there and do a public outreach and really, really get it through to people we're in dire straits with the library, people aren't going to get it. I mean, they're just going to see it as another tax. And that concerns me. So I think that outreach is critical to making this work. And my big concern is that do we have enough time? Now, the one thing I did say to Supervisor Farr was that we're ready to go with our initiative, and why not learn from our experiences and then go countywide, see how we do. But I do understand her point of wanting it because I know all the libraries are in need. But those are my fears, that we're just not going to have much time to really get that message out.
Council Member Aceves.
Can we put that general fund contribution slide up, please? There you go. First of all, we need to make one correction. It's not Santa Maria, it's Santa Maria. Maria. Oh,
yeah.
Don't want to embarrass her.
Duly noted.
All right. Now, on this chart here, is it only the city of Santa Maria and Santa Barbara that run their own libraries? Or does Lompoc run their own library?
I think Lompoc now runs their own, correct.
Okay, so when we say a countywide tax, we're only talking about Buellton, Carpinteria, Guadalupe, Solvang, and Goleta.
No, I believe the proposal is that every parcel in the county would be taxed regardless of jurisdiction or local agency.
So
it
requires Santa Maria, who already contributes $1.5 million, and Santa Barbara, that already contributes $3.2 million, to them to buy in on a countywide tax. Mm. And if they didn't, then how many cities would be required or to pass this? First of all, and would it still pass if we excised to the two biggest contributors in the county?
Unfortunately, we don't have that information. And the recent information that was provided late last week regarding how this tax might work, we have not yet received. So we hope to have more information tomorrow at the Library Advisory Committee meeting to better understand how this might work.
Is Santa Barbara participating in the library committees?
Oh, yes. The library director is there.
Because the biggest thing the county's pushing is it says local agencies must make a good faith statement that tax proceeds are supplemental. Mm-hmm. So the city of Santa Barbara, as an example, would have to continue to make their $3.2 million and tax their residents the additional fee for the parcel tax. Which makes it kind of a really an uphill battle when you go for a countywide tax increase. When you look at somebody like the city of Santa Barbara, even Santa Maria, the amount of money that their communities are already spending, and now we're asking for the parcel larger parcel tax. Second question has to do with our DIF fees. How much do we have in the bank for DIF fees now and projected in the next 5 years? Do we know?
I don't have that handy.
Our finance director has that at her fingertips. We'll give her a moment.
She's pulling out her budget book to access that.
While she's researching that, the other cities that are participating in the Library Advisory Committee, and mind you, it is advisory, mm-hmm. have they provided budgets similar to what we have done, showing where we are and where we're going to be unless we augment our income?
To my knowledge, I'm not sure that they've done that to the degree that we have.
So we don't know. They could be in the same boat that we're in, whereas they're going red sooner than later.
I don't know. Allison may know. The city of Santa Barbara may have done that analysis on behalf of the libraries that they serve. I don't have that information readily available, but it's certainly something that we can look into. The sense from the Library Advisory Committee members and all the representatives that sit on that committee and attend the meetings is that all of the libraries are in very difficult shape financially, and many of them are cutting back in order to stay within operating revenue.
It'd be great if you put that on the agenda to get that back from the different groups so that we know that we're not the only ones in this situation. I think it helps with the arguments to bring in the bigger cities to join us to help if it's going to be a countywide tax.
I think we can also add to that information which cities have not returned to their pre-recession service and staffing mm-hmm. levels because of the tax measure L tax here in Goleta. We've actually been able to maintain a higher service level, and also we've had contributions from the Friends of the Library and reserves for the Goleta Library, which we drew on. Other libraries in the county did not have those resources available, so I think we may find that in several cases they're worse off than Goleta. But we'll go ahead and put all that data together and bring it back.
It'd be important to know that. And yes, we are very fortunate to have the Friends through the years helping us. I mean, we closed the door on Fridays one time because we didn't have the money, and they came and stepped up. So do we have the answer on our DIF fees?
Yes. Currently, our fund balance in the DIF fund is $173,000. On a program basis in the five-year CIP, we look at anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 a year based on development activity.
$150,000 a year?
$150,000 to $200,000. Again, that's based on development activity, when permits are pulled and when we collect that fee. So as of right now, though, fund balance, it's $173,000.
And the library DIF fees can only be used for the library?
Yes.
And only certain types of expenditures?
Correct.
The way that DIF was set up by the county years ago, we can actually use it to purchase books. But other than that, it cannot be used for operations.
How about maintenance?
No, not maintenance. It is limited.
How do we change that?
That's a legal question, actually, how we change a pre-established DIF fee.
Well, in establishing the DIF fee, it's established by ordinance and in the collection. You'd have to go back, amend the ordinance, and you would have to go back and reanalyze and reestablish the financial need underlying that fee. So basically, you would have a separate fee going forward, which could encumber those additional items.
How difficult is that to get that done? Because here's my concern. We're giving them $10,000 a year. And you just said we're bringing in $173,000 that we can only use for books. Unless we
books
buy
or other improvements, expanding the facility, those types of things that... similar to what you can use public admin DIF fees or park DIF fees for.
The whole idea with your development impact fee is that they are paying only their fair share of the library system that they're going to be impacting. So that which is existing, which is serving existing developments, is paid for by existing development. So therefore, that's why it typically tracks with those infrastructure as opposed to operational issues. Now,
the analysis would have to go through and say, here's why the operation is just not getting more expensive to operate at the same level, which I think is what a lot of these reports are saying. We're providing the same level of service for a higher dollar amount. It's not because there's additional demand. It just costs more to do that. That's not something that you can pass on to new development. New development can only be charged for its fair share of that. The difficulty is not terribly difficult to go through it and come up with a new DIF. Certainly, this is less complex than our GTIP, but that's something, an effort that's been undergoing for years to try and update our GTIP DIF.
Okay. I think that's something that I would like to see looked into, at least to see what other options we have. The other thing I'd like to know, and maybe staff can put together the numbers, other than our $10,000 contribution, and now we're going to give 30 if the council agrees, how much more on an annual basis do we budget for the library? So I think the public needs to know the bigger picture, that we're just not giving $10,000, we're not just giving $30,000, we're actually doing facility improvements as needed, because we do own the building. We have that already?
We did in a previous staff report include that. It may actually be attached to the attachment one to your staff report is the letter that was submitted to the Board of Supervisors, and there's a budget attached to that, which includes all the other information or support that we provide to the library. Let me make sure that was attached.
Is that the city
library? I believe support? If you look at big page 9 of the report, under attachment 1, there's a table there that lists City of Goleta contribution, and it does call out maintenance, collection, expansion, which is the $10,000, then the DIF fees.
Right.
The city grants that we've given in support of the Friends, and then direct support, the professional services.
Is that this?
Yes.
Right, the back of the report?
Yeah, looks like this.
Okay.
Oh, it's more.
And then my final question is, where are the other cities on this idea?
We don't have any feedback at this point from the other cities. Again, it's something that's being discussed at the Library Advisory Committee tomorrow, and there's been some conversation about the county providing an update to the individual cities so that they have some information about how this might move forward.
So they haven't weighed in, and all the times you've met on the issue of a countywide tax, or that's a new issue?
The countywide parcel tax is a relatively new proposal that is being discussed at the Library Advisory Committee level only at this point. It has not gone out countywide for discussion with the local jurisdictions.
When's the next city manager's meeting? I'm just going.
There was one last week. The topic was brought up, and there was a request that the county CAO reach out to each city with further information. I haven't heard that anything has gone out since that time, but it's been less than a week, so we'll definitely keep an eye on that.
I kind of think we should be proactive on this. I think we should contact each city, ask them to think about it, and think about sending a letter to the County Board of Supervisors like we did, and push this forward a little faster than having to wait until it's their timetable, because we're running out of time. If we want to get it in the November ballot, we have to have it done by June?
I believe it's June, July at the very latest, to take action.
Okay.
I think that's a good idea, though, if it means anything.
So the recommendation before you this evening is to confirm the intention of making a general fund contribution of $30,000 to help sustain the library operations. And then that would be, that's incorporated into the mid-year budget report that will follow this item. And then also to indicate conceptual support for a countywide library ballot measure.
I'll make a motion. I don't know what the word conceptually, though. The motion that I'd make is one that we
We do make the general fund contribution of $30,000. That it come back during the, well, it'll be in the mid-year budget review that we're going to see soon. And secondly, that we support a countywide library ballot measure and that we encourage the other cities to weigh in and respond to it.
Second. All those in support say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Well, it passes unanimously. Is that it, Ms. Ripa?
That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Very nicely done. Let me say, with, at the risk of appearing like a big baby, I'm freezing over here. Is there? Do we have a heater in here?
We didn't pay our gas bill.
I'll be happy to throw down $20 or something if we could crank it up.
I'm sweating.
Oh, I think it comes down. I think it's like right here.
Oh, you are shivering. Yeah, we got to get the heat going.
Yeah, I know. I'm skinny these days, and
I'm not. I'm cold. So. It's the way the air comes in this room.
Yeah, well, we can go ahead and have the thermostat adjusted. In the meantime, I believe we're ready for item B3. If council's ready to move on.
Okay, let's do that. Councilmember Perotti, will you move a little closer? No. Jeannie Wilson, would you inform us?
Yes, Mayor and members of the City Council. This afternoon I will present to you the fiscal year 2015-16 mid-year budget modifications staff report. I do want to point out that the attachment Exhibit A to the resolution amending the budget has been corrected. We did omit one item, which was related to a capital improvement project that has been revised and I believe distributed to council.
What is the project on A?
It's the capital project was Los Caneros. It's Exhibit A, last item on Exhibit A of the resolution amending the budget.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do is, start with the original budget as adopted. Council approved that budget, I believe, on June 9th of this 2015. The budget was adopted at $22.3 million. As with every year, once we enter a new fiscal year, we do carry over project budgets. These are funds that have not been expended to the budget. We also carry over encumbrances, and these are commitments for contracts the city has entered into. So at the end of the fiscal year, those are reservations of fund balance. And then when the new year begins, July 1, those budgets get rolled over and, in effect, increase your budget for the year. Additionally, council has made some additional appropriations during the last 6 months, or six months, at $279,000. I'll be showing you a chart that shows these figures from beginning budget adoption to current budget. And then I will be covering your mid-year recommended adjustments. So currently our budget is at $23.9 million. We are going to be discussing some operating revenue adjustments of $758,000 and increases to operating expenditures by $676,900. So on this table you'll see our original budget as adopted with the revisions that I identified for carryover budgets, encumbrances and new appropriations during the first half of the year. What this chart will show is our operating revenues and our operating expenditures, because we want to look at those a little differently than capital expenditures. Capital expenditures are generally one-time expenditures. So if you look at the net operating figure, you'll see that revenues exceed expenditures. After capital expenditures, you'll see that our net operating after capital is a deficit. Just wanted to point out we're not deficit budgeting. This is as a result of those one-time monies that are set aside in fund balance at the end of the year, and then we roll them into the new year. So it's important to see, and I believe your interim finance director started presenting information to council in this manner, which is important to note that your operating revenues are budgeted to cover your operating expenditures. What I'd like to cover first is your overall revenues are tracking at mid-year at 35.4%. We are not at 50%. That's because our revenues don't generally overall come in at an even 1/12 of each month or 50% through mid-year. But it is trending to last year's figures and to historical figures. The chart also reflected on the PowerPoint right now is your tax revenue. These are our most significant revenues, and right now those are tracking and trending along with prior year activity at 33%. And those are property tax, sales tax, TOT, and franchise fees. As a result of the activity for the first half of the year, staff is recommending an increase to our property tax our budget. We receive county assessed valuation reports in September or October of each year. And in effect, we essentially get a revised number of what our actual revenue will be, and that indicates that we'll be receiving an additional $150,000. We did see Goleta experience an 8% increase in assessed valuation overall, and as provided by county reports, that was the highest in the county for this past year. In reviewing the transient occupancy tax, as of the report through December, we had information for 4 months. As of the time I did the staff report, I reviewed information for 6 months, and I'm recommending an increase to TOT of $270,000 based on actual TOT receipts through December and a projection of 3% for the remaining part of the year. We do review these numbers each month. And do analysis to track the hotel activity to ensure we're tracking with our budget estimates. We saw an increase in license service charge revenues as well. Again, this is as a result of increased building activity, which continues and is expected through the remainder of this year. But we are at 62% as of December 2015. As you can see on the chart, we are at 62%. Our building permit activity is trending well above the 50%. Public works deposits earned also trending well above, and plan check fees also trending well above. In light of that, staff is recommending adjustments to those revenue line items. Overall, licenses and services, $360,000. Building permit activity, $233,000 increase. Public works deposits earned, almost $28,000 increase. And plan check fees increasing by $100,000. I will point out that building permit and plan check fee revenue is contracted out. Those services are contracted out to Wildan, and the city retains 25% of these revenues and pays for those services at 75% of the fees collected. So you'll see a corresponding increase on the expenditure side for their services. Some other minor adjustments. We did an interest revenue increase of $10,000 based on trending activity. Overall, a decrease in reimbursements, and this is a two-part adjustment. We are reducing CIP recovery costs. That's essentially the cost we're recovering for staff time. That's primarily as a result of vacancies in that division. The goal is to track staff time and recover those costs from those various projects funded by GTIP, DIF, federal grants, and make the general fund whole eventually, or attempt to make the general fund whole for a good part of the salaries expended on those activities. We are also increasing RDA revenue reimbursement. This is not new money. It was just an oversight at the budget adoption that revenue was omitted, so we're adding it back into the mid-year as an adjustment. So overall, revenues are increasing at $758,000 for the mid-year overall revenue. As you can see now, with those recommended adjustments, our revenues will be at $24.27 million after these adjustments. Staff evaluated expenditures. Again, this evaluation was based on a program budget basis, and we are looking at about 48% spending through December. of that figure, does it also include encumbrances for those activities? So our current budget as adopted is $23.9 million. We have various mid-year budget adjustments recommended for salaries and operations, and I'll be reviewing those in detail. This chart just shows our 48% through mid-year in line with last year's 44%, same time frame. I'd first like to cover changes and recommendations to changes related to personnel cost. Included in your mid-year is a recommendation for the addition of four positions. That would be in the city manager's office, an HR/risk manager position to address the growing needs of the reporting requirements and recruitment requirements in that department. Parks and Recreation, or Parks and Open Space, or and including maintenance, we are recommending a maintenance worker two positions, and in Public Works, a senior office specialist, one position. As a result of the Baker Tilly organizational assessment, staff evaluated the need, and it appeared that these positions were highly recommended based on the activity and as per the presentation you heard earlier today. As with every mid-year cycle and budget, we also take a look at our opportunities to address efficiencies and organizational structure overall within the city. And as a result of that, we are making some additional recommendations. We are proposing to move the code enforcement officer position from neighborhood services to the planning department. We are recommending adjustments to management assistant and senior office specialist reallocations between the city attorney's office and the city manager's office. There's also reclassification proposed for the current PIO to a community relations manager to address additional needs needed by that department. We did make an adjustment to all the figures in each department for a PERS percentage factor correction. The factor used in the original budget was at the old rate. We trued up that based on the current rate, and as was done with the first quarter adjustments, we are now going to show the unfunded accrued liability costs, which we allocated non-departmental budget to the actual budgets within each department. So just cleaned up the reporting, so each department will actually reflect the PERS percentage factor and the unfunded accrued liability for each department. Overall, the fiscal impact of personnel costs for mid-years is just over $83,000. On an annual basis, for these adjustments and new positions, we're looking at about $330,000 year to year. Operating expenditures, there are a number of recommendations. I'll start going through those as well. In the city manager's department, we are looking at transferring $30,000 for studies related to the library to the library program fund program budget, as was discussed in the previous staff report. The city attorney is requesting an additional appropriation from general fund litigation reserves in the amount of $200,000. Finance, we're looking at decreasing a budget decrease of $35,000. This is as a result of a user fee study that will not be implemented this year. That study will be implemented once the zoning ordinance is adopted. So we anticipate that you'll see a request for this study in next year's budget. Support services has a number of increases, $162,000 overall. This is primarily as a result of additional work needed in the HR risk management area. $39,000. That is a reduction of our risk management reserves and fund balance. We do need an increase of $10,000 for office supplies and recruitment costs. $50,000 in increase for IT equipment and maintenance for new staffing and upgraded technology for the traffic engineer, and some GIS support as well. And $62,000 in increase for an expansion of the second floor, covering lease, CAM, and utility costs. That space is needed for expanded positions, as was discussed previously, with the recruitments that we have pending. As I mentioned, there is a significant increase in the building department's program budget. $250,000 approximately. And again, that's as a result of additional revenues that we're currently receiving as because of the increased building activity. The $61,000 is the remaining balance for the zoning ordinance project that has been unspent and is needed for the contract amendment that came forward to council earlier today. Engineering is requesting $27,000 for a replacement truck, and that will be a reduction from our equipment reserves in fund balance as well. Street maintenance is requesting an increase of over $100,000. This is primarily for a traffic signal at Hollister and Glen Annie per a developer reimbursement requirement. And $7,800, an increase for machinery equipment for a trailer. Again, this would be a reduction of our equipment reserve fund balance. So overall, a summary, our budget on an operating budget, on an operating basis is $22.4 million. With our adjustments for operating related expenses, $676,000, we would have an operating budget of $23.1 million. And that the changes that we're recommending are not capital related, they're just operating related. What that means is our revenues exceed the recommended expenditure increases by $81,000. As with each quarter, this is a on a budget basis, our projected fund balance reserves. As you can see, we did reduce several categories, capital equipment, risk management, and litigation defense fund reserves to offset those increases in expenditures and appropriations provided to you. So our expectation is our ending fund balance would be at $13.6 million at the end of the budget year, and that's based on us receiving everything we've budgeted and spending everything we've programmed, which generally is not the case. So I would anticipate our fund balance reserve being slightly higher than 13.6. As with each quarter, we talk a little bit about revenue neutrality and point out that in sales tax, the county shares $2.8 million estimated this year, and property tax $2.9 million estimated this year, for a total of $5.7 million to the county under the RNA agreement. And it's a little small, but there is a slide for the historical RNA contributions to the county. The number is broken by the TOT sales tax and property tax categories, and historical to date is at $98 million based on our figures. We did take a look at all other funds. These are our special revenue funds and grant funds on a budget to actual basis. We reviewed fund balance and the only deficit fund balances that are reflected in your report relate to grant funds. These are funds where we spend the money and then request reimbursement. So it's not uncommon to have deficit fund balances on several of those funds. We also reviewed our capital improvement program projects by project, and we are only recommending one project for adjustment, and that is the Los Caneros at Hollister widening. We are recommending a $38,000 appropriation, and this will be the final reimbursement to the developer for this project. After my presentation, the Public Works Director, Rosemary Gaglione, will be presenting an update on all the capital improvement projects currently underway with the city. Once we wrap up this mid-year process, we will be starting on the new budget cycle. Wanted to point out a few things. We will plan a couple of budget workshops with the City Council to discuss programs and strategies for the next coming budget. And at that workshop, we do anticipate a further evaluation of the organizational structure and staffing needs. There will be a discussion of a parking enforcement officer, potentially with the county sheriff's department. Additional information will be provided to council with regard to potential revenues and costs related to this position and program under that contract. Finance staff did meet with the finance committee in January to discuss the CalPERS unfunded actuarial liability. and received direction that we will present to you at the workshop as far as funding that on an annual basis at a shorter amortization period for an earlier payoff of that liability. We also discussed with the Finance Committee a retiree health benefits trust fund. Currently, the city maintains $333,000 in reserve fund balance for this fund. Staff will pursue presenting and taking action or bringing forward to council action that would formalize a trust fund, which would mean the funds would be designated, set aside, and not available, as is the case currently with a reserve of fund balance. So these are some additional items to be discussed in the next budget process. I'm available for any questions, and I would ask Council to consider the adoption of the accompanying resolutions with regard to personnel and amendments to the budget. And as I mentioned, after this presentation or questions, Rosemary will be presenting a status update on all capital improvement program budgets.
All right. Are there questions?
I just have a couple, actually.
Councilmember Cibes.
On the street maintenance, page 18, you said there's a $100,000 increase for signals per a development reimbursement requirement. Does that mean, what does that mean?
I believe Kathleen Trepa will address that question.
A portion of this is associated with the work that was done in the Store Collister area, part of which was done with as part of the development improvement projects out there, the public improvements for the signals. And also we installed an interconnect system to tie together the three signals from Stork, South Glen Annie, and the Marketplace. And that was done with using some of the previously budgeted traffic signal maintenance funds, and now we're reimbursing the account for that effort.
Okay, so this is just crediting the development reimbursement for the money we spent.
It's crediting back to that account, yes.
Okay, it's not expending because of some agreement.
No.
All right.
Other questions?
I had one more real quick. On the last thing, dealing with the revenue neutrality, it's not as high as we thought it was going to be. I thought we were talking $110 million.
These figures are from our records from 01-02.
I think, if I might, John, your predecessor used to do a present value calculation.
Okay.
And that's what he was taking that and projecting out 20 years. And that's where you got your $100-some-odd million. This is the actual money we've spent without any kind of present value calculation associated with it. That's, you weren't here for that, obviously.
Okay.
But
leave it to the CPA. Okay. I'm good.
I can make a comment about police officers, but I like most of them, so I won't.
Well, we like spending money. That's what we do.
All right. Any other questions? Yeah. Councilmember Perotti.
Most of my questions have been answered because I sit on the Finance and Audit Committee, and thank you for helping us out and such a thorough report. But I do, after re-looking and re-reading this, I just have one concern over the reclassification of the community relations or public information officer position. And my concern is that she is so busy at this point, we're adding a whole lot more onto her plate. Are we going to get her an assistant? I mean, I'm concerned about adding more.
There is a support position that's already budgeted for that division, and we're currently in recruitment, which would lead us to hopefully find a candidate to fill that vacancy.
Okay, good.
So that's there will be support.
Okay, good. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, well, I would like to say you did a very fine job with this, Ms. Wilson. And I, for one, and I know there are others up here, appreciate you throwing dirt on the county for the RNA, so thank you for that.
Okay.
I'm prepared to go forward with the motion if everybody's ready to go forward with that.
Yeah, I think we are.
Okay. Staff recommendation A, adopt resolution number 16, next in order, entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, amending the city's operating and CIP budget fiscal year 15-16. Staff recommendation B, adopt resolution number 16, next in order, entitled a resolution of the City Council of the City of Goleta, California, amending the City of Goleta's salary schedule and classification plan for fiscal year 15-16, adding the classification specifications of human resources risk manager and community relations manager.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
Thank you.
Mayor Farr, members of the council, Liana's working out some technical difficulties here.
While we're sorting out the presentation, I just wanted to let council know that staff meets on a monthly basis to discuss the status of the CIP projects. We have an internal staff committee that does this, but it occurred to us that typically you don't get that many updates on our progress with the CIP program. So our intention is to be able to produce tables like we attach to the staff report on a monthly basis to provide council and the public. So you'll see the progress with the projects as they go, rather than waiting months, years, however long it takes, depending on the size of a project, for a ribbon cutting or something of that nature. So we're trying to work on how we communicate with you and the public and increase those opportunities to share information with you. So this is our first official effort under the new way of tracking our revised CIP. So we'll be making adjustments and improvements so that our communication tools are more informative. And just want you to know that's on the horizon.
You're still dark. Is it just trying to tell us something, or
Rosemary pulled the cord over there?
I think Rosemary's trying to tell us to think is what she's trying.
I did my homework, really.
put an engineer in.
Thank you very much, David. All right. Mayor Farr, members of the council, finally, the capital improvement program mid-year update. I'm going to go through rather quickly most of these projects. We have updated you fairly recently. In projects where they show up as a construct design in 1 year and construction later, we're only going to present graphics one time. So you'll see that missing if the project comes up twice. So this year we're going to be going out into construction for the path lighting project, the Boys and Girls Club, the Hollister-Avenue crosswalk enhancements, which is the Hawk in front of the community center, Hollister Avenue crosswalk enhancement at Orange, and those two are going to go together, rebuilding, not just resurfacing, our evergreen tennis courts, putting lighting in the Maria Ignacio bike path, and working a new project, Covington storm drainage enhancements, and our Hollister Class 1 bike path. So this is the path that kids walk down from Hollister Avenue down to the Boys and Girls Club. The project will include removing some fencing, putting in lighting, improvement of the path, and also some paving and or slurrying in the parking lots. So it's currently in design. The front end documents are in review with legal, and we plan to go out to bid in March or April, and then construction in July, August. And there is, you can see the location of that's the current location of the crosswalk, and we're going to be coming back to you March 1st to look at the new location. So the Hollister Avenue crosswalk improvements, as I said, are in the final design phase, and we have submitted, this was the Highway Safety Improvement Program money, so we've submitted for those funds. This is the crosswalk enhancement project at Orange. Once again, this is what will go along with the Hawk project. This is just refreshing all of the paint and putting in rectangular rapid flashing beacons to replace the old style yellow flashing beacons. And that is going to go out to bid in March or April of this year. Evergreen tennis courts. The tennis courts need to be completely rebuilt. and that will give us, you know, a good 30, 40-year lifespan rather than trying to patch what's out there. We did a lot of investigation to see what the best course of action was. So it's in final design. That'll go out to bid also in March or April of this year and go into construction in July.
Can I ask a question on that one?
Yes.
The problem with that, not only is the court, but those the fencing gets tagged on a weekly basis. How are we going to address that?
Well, the fencing will be replaced. We'll put in new mesh. In terms of addressing tagging, I think once the courts are in use again, that might discourage some of it, and we would need to ask law enforcement to patrol more often.
Okay, what about cleanup? I'm not familiar. I know there are some paint for walls that help you with graffiti. Is there such a thing for mesh?
I think you could spray paint the mesh just as much as someone tags the mesh. You could get up and spray paint the mesh. You just couldn't use a roller. Okay, the Maria Ignacio bike path lighting project. This is just completing the lighting that the county did most of the project, and we have to take care of the area below Hollister Avenue and the bridge. That's in final design and also is going out to bid this year in March or April and construction this summer. Covington Storm Drainage, this is a new project between taking storm drainage from Cathedral Oaks out, and also out of the orchards and down to Lake Los Carneros near Cayo Laguna Vista. So it gives you a little picture of the inlet up at the top on Cathedral Oaks and then where it comes down into Lake Los Carneros. The fix for this may very well be installing a new drainage line down Camino Laguna Vista toward the lake.
Is that where the cleanup was done recently up on the Covington area?
Yes. Yes. The other option would be to actually burst the pipe and put in a larger pipe that goes through private property and alongside of the house. So I think it's better to go down the road and put in a new pipe. So that's in the final design phase and should go out to bid in May. And the Hollister Class 1 bikeway project from Pacific Oaks Drive over to Elwood Elementary School. Your typical section here. This provides a Class 1 bike path for kids going to school, for folks just wanting to enjoy a safe ride along a separated bike path, and final design and going out to bid in May. So projects that are either in design or will begin design this fiscal year will be Ward Class 2 bike lanes, Equifowler Road extensions, Hollister Avenue Bridge replacement, the San Jose Creek bike path middle and southern extents, the Cathedral Oaks landscaping, Old Town sidewalk infill, our overlay project and our miscellaneous concrete projects, Bella Vista reclaimed waterline, miscellaneous facilities, improvements, Hollister widening from Stork to 280 feet west of Glen Annie, and Stork widening Phelps to city limits. So the Class 2 bike lanes project just installs Class 2 bike lanes on Ward Drive from Hollister down to the Auburn Trail in design, and we anticipate doing construction in 16-17. Equifowler Road Extension Project, design is 80 or 90% complete. We're in right-of-way acquisition, and we're working working with the City of Santa Barbara to do a runway protection zone analysis, and that's underway, and construction will be in 17-18. Hollister Avenue Bridge Replacement Project will go at the same time. Design is almost complete in right-of-way phase and construction in 17-18. San Jose Creek Bike Path Project, the middle extent from Cayo Real to Hollister. Segment 1 is in design. It's 95% complete in right-of-way. Construction is unknown right now because it's tied to the park project. Segment 2, which is from Cayo Real down to approximately Armitos, is in preliminary design, and the environmental is nearly complete. Now, this is the southern extent of the San Jose Creek Bike Path. You can see where the creek goes underneath the highway there. Caltrans is replacing that bridge on 217, and that will provide width for us to go ahead and install the bike path. So we're in the project study report, project development support phase. Our Cathedral Oaks Interchange Landscaping Project. It's in design and request for authorization to Caltrans for funds will occur in June, and we anticipate construction this next fiscal year. Old Town Sidewalk Infill Project, you recently received an update on that. You have some additional photos here. It's currently in preliminary engineering, and design and right-of-way phase contracts will go out in July, August. We have to wait until our time comes up to go ahead and request allocation for those funds from Caltrans for the grant money. Bella Vista Reclaim Waterline, that is right now in our preliminary engineering phase. We're lining up a contract project manager to assist us with that project. Miscellaneous facilities improvements. This is a collection of improvements for the community center in Stowe House and the library and some of our outbuildings at Stowe House. And that's also in the preliminary engineering phase. Hollister Avenue Widening Project, that will add a lane from Hollister to about 280 feet west of South Glen Annie Road. So that'll complete the widening that was begun as part of the West Star project. And that is also in the preliminary engineering phase. Projects starting design next year, Cathedral Oaks interim crib wall repair, the bike ped master plan, Hollister complete streets, our 101 overpass, miscellaneous park improvements, rectangular rapid flashing beacon in Hollister at Chapel, and a hawk at Hollister at Kingston, our Rancho La Patera improvements, Evergreen Park water line, and Stork Road medians. And there's our crib wall. So we are having a geologist take a look and see how much loss of material there may be and begin to look at what needs to be done to repair that. So that's in the preliminary engineering phase. Our bike ped master plan, we will be bringing a recommendation for a consultant award, contract award in April, and community outreach in summer, and working on the projects in spring of 2017. And we expect that our plan will be completed and come to you in 2017. Hollister Avenue Complete Streets Corridor Program, our Tiger Grant. So we expect consultant award in April, and traffic and engineering studies will begin in May, and public outreach will begin in summer of 2016. The Highway 101 Overpass Project, it's currently in preliminary engineering. We will be coming to you with a phased approach to picking up again on the project approval and design. Miscellaneous park improvements, those include Winchester 1 and 2, Andamar, and San Miguel, and that is to replace aging playground equipment, and that'll be phased over 4 years. Rectangular rapid flashing beacon there at Hollister and Chapel, and a hawk at Kyrie in Kingston. These are Highway Safety Improvement Program grant, and we'll begin design in next fiscal year. Rancho La Patera, that's in our planning phase. Evergreen Reclaim Water Line is also in planning phase. Stark Road medians, we're gonna be looking at modifying the medians to add more a turn pocket length there, the left turn from Stork on Hollister, and that's also preliminary engineering. And we'll be going out to bid or construction next fiscal year on our Cathedral Oaks landscaping project, miscellaneous park improvements, and miscellaneous facility improvements.
Can I ask a question on that? Going back to the Rancho La Patera, is that the water line?
Yeah, that's the water line. That is parking lot improvements. Okay. All of that.
What about this reclaimed water line we're thinking of? Are we considering if the water district decides to go in full bore into recycled water and the potable water, and I mean, it kind of defeats the purpose then at that point of using reclaimed water, doesn't it?
Are you referring to the blending?
Yeah, I know it's not going to happen tomorrow or anything, yeah. But they're considering it, right?
I believe the district is considering,
yes,
whether or not the public will accept. I think there's still, you know, a long way to go in the public psyche.
Yeah, I would think so.
But getting the Bella Vista water line in, that will go ahead. That's the first part. That's closest to where we can hook up. Mm-hmm. And then we would extend from that line onto Evergreen.
All right. I guess if the public ever comes around on that, then we could change our plans here, I suppose, at that point, right? If we needed to.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. And I guess the question we'd all ask ourselves, asking ourselves how comfortable we are.
Yes.
With that, so.
Absolutely.
There's no new water. That's true, you know. It's all recycled.
At some point
one way or another.
Yeah.
Reclaimed.
Yes.
Okay. So these park improvements will be phased over a four-year period. We have the Armitos Bridge Feasibility Study. Ms. Garcia is going to be presenting that to you, I believe, at the March 1st council meeting. And the La Patera over or under crossing is going on right now. So here is the where Armitos Bridge would be. And where the La Patera, either an over or under crossing, would be. And the feasibility study on that, as I said, is currently underway. The fire station, Civic Center, and Kellogg Park. So the fire station, a county MOU was approved, and the city needs to be approved, I'm sorry, and the city council already approved that in January.
Specifically only on the Armitos Bridge, is that funded?
No. Okay. No, we will be, the deal would be if we come to you and we show you these are options, and we're going to be asking council for direction. And once we have that direction, that would be then a new project. We could start to look at grant funding for that and see how far we need to get with preliminary engineering to make it a viable grant application.
Okay.
So Civic Center, right now its feasibility study is still ongoing. Here's a Kellogg Park. Revised design due to water restrictions going to Park and Rec Commission in May of 2016. And the Amtrak Depot, which is in property acquisition negotiations. LED lighting project. They're completing the streetlight inventory and working with Edison on acquisition costs if we were to go ahead and purchase all of the lights that Edison currently owns. That completes my mid-year update. Are there any questions?
It's always fun to listen to your report. So, Councilmember Bennett.
I was curious about the impact of the buses in front of Rusty's on Stork Road. I noticed there wasn't anything here in regards to that, and that's an issue that I consistently get complaints on, and because of the redesign of the road, and the buses, typically two of them are parked there, mm-hmm. and it creates a real gridlock with people coming out of the marketplace making a left onto Stork. Mm-hmm.
We are working with MTD to see if it's possible to go ahead and move that bus stop down in front of the mattress store. But we have a lot of work to do with when, I don't know if the county built the sidewalk or if the owners of the mattress store built the sidewalk, but the entire sidewalk comes up to meet the level of the front door of the mattress store. So we have to look and see what it's going to take to make that ADA accessible and solve that problem.
That was all changed when the marketplace was built, because that's when Stork Road was widened. So okay. It didn't look like that before that. But why would you not look at the area south of Bolay Drive where you don't have that impact? And there's a lot of room to do a pocket. They're essentially tearing out the landscape. Mm-hmm. So it would seem to me there's a great deal of room there to consider a location for stopping, especially when you've got two buses. And you wouldn't have that interaction of people wanting to make a right turn into the Kmart shopping center, mm-hmm. for example. And I just think it reduces that impact of traffic interaction if it's south of Bolay Drive.
Personally, I like that idea very much. MTD doesn't like it as much because of the people having to walk from Hollister to the next bus stop. If we're unable to make this location work, then we may be able to move that down. But they're looking at serving their customers and the distance that they have to walk between if they get off and they want to transfer from one spot to the other, what that might mean for them. So this is what we're trying to work with them to find a bus stop that location that works for traffic and works for their customers as well. So this is one of the conversations that we had in the field.
My observation is that when the customers get off the bus in front of Rusty's, they don't go to the signal now. They look both directions and wait for the cars to open a bit, and they run across the street, stand in the center median, and when there's an opening on the west side, then they run across Stork to get to the buses that are parked over on the west side.
Which is another reason we're very much in favor of moving the bus stop to the south. But we are working with MTD on that, and I agree. If all things being equal, that's a better location.
Okay. Thank you.
If I can add something on that, the MTD is currently looking at all our lines in Goleta.
because of the increased ridership, UCSB, and also the increase of City College students in IV. With the articulated buses now running with great frequency, finding spots for them, and so we're looking at the at all the lines. You may have read in the paper where MTD is now half million less in ridership district-wide. And so we're trying to address that not only from a financial point, but also to readdress where to put the lines. And Goleta is like number one because of the increase we have out here. So we'll be seeing more. And in fact, I think in March, there's going to be a MTD board meeting here in our chambers.
Council Member Vallejo.
On the projects that are going to bid, would it be possible for me to get an estimate on completion dates on these? I mean, I know the ones that are just in design, that's a tough one to predict, but I mean, I'm especially looking at the first three there. Those three all relate to, you know, the kids in Old Town getting to the Boys Club and everything else, among others. And so I'd like to see a timeline on that so we know when we can...
We can provide timeline for a construction completion estimate for all of those. So,
thank you.
We know how many working days we have in there. So part of that is, you know, once you get your award and you want to make sure you have a good contract, you know, you get your apparent lowest responsible bidder. Mm-hmm. There may be issues. I mean, we've had cases where maybe a contractor doesn't have a valid contractor's license for what they're bidding on. So
Okay. That
would be the only, but we'll get you, if all things go well, we'll get you estimates for all of that.
That's great. Cause that's what the public asks us too, is when is this going to be done? So, okay. Thank you.
Anybody else have a comment? Yeah, no, you folks did real well, as always, so thank you for that.
You're very busy.
Yes.
I'm exhausted looking at this.
Okay. We're going to do council comments now.
Mr. Mayor, we do have item B4 to still come before you.
Okay.
I know we're ready to go if you are. However, if you'd like to take a break, that's fine as well.
What am I doing?
If you would like us to proceed with item B4 or if you'd like to take a break.
Oh, gee, yeah, okay. Does anybody need a break? No? All right, let's persevere.
Item B4, consideration of a proposed sphere of influence expansion.
Good afternoon, council members. I will go fast. Government Code Section 56425 requires that LAFCOs update spheres of influence every 5 years. On November 2nd of 2005, the city received an inquiry from Paul Hood, the executive officer of our LAFCO, inquiring whether the city would like to pursue changes to our sphere. City staff responded that city council will need to provide that direction and on whether it's the right time to pursue such an amendment. When the general plan was adopted in 2006, 5 potential sub-areas were identified as future service areas. A future service area is defined as the geographic area which the city anticipates requesting to be included as part of its sphere of influence, and therefore an area that could be annexed into city territory at some future date. The future service areas include 5 separate sub-areas identified in section LU 12.2 of policy LU 12, listed as sub-areas A through E, that are represented in the maps in attachment 2 and 3 in your staff report. The establishment and possible expansion of a sphere of influence was written into the general plan also as an implementation action that reads LU-IA implementation action 2, adoption of sphere of influence for Goleta. So what would be the objectives of pursuing an expansion? One objective is to create a logical service pattern where the infrastructure is contiguous with the city limits. A second objective is for the city to have a greater say in future development decisions for properties within the sphere. And a third objective is to implement the general plan policy that relates to future service areas. In 2008, the city submitted an application to LAFCO requesting a sphere of influence that included the existing city boundary and sub-areas A, C, and E in attachment 2. The application was denied, and the sphere of influence has remained as the city limits. Based on the discussions and significant community feedback that occurred in 2008 and in early 2009, And recently, when this issue came up at LAFCO, whether or not the city of Goleta would pursue such an expansion, staff would recommend a limited or smaller request if council chose to go forward, consisting of only subareas D and subarea E to be considered if council desires to move forward with this sphere of influence expansion request at this time. That's all.
All right. Are there questions from council? Okay, Councilmember Bennett.
What would be the advantage to the city for subarea D, like in David, dog?
Mm-hmm.
Since it's all land, if I recall correctly, that's owned by the university, which we absolutely have no say-so over. And we would receive, I don't believe, anything in the way of property tax other than possessory interest tax if it was privately used.
Well, the one advantage would be a cooperative agreement of, well, more cooperation than we already do have with the university in relation to environmental protection of that area, particularly the slope. So the Devereaux area and sort of the environmental improvements that are being done out there, it would be an opportunity to expand on our already cooperative agreements that we have in place.
Okay.
But you are correct. There's no, wouldn't really see major development. It probably would never actually be annexed into the city because it is owned by the university.
Well, plus, as I recall, and of course, law may have changed, so I know it does that, but my last recollection is unless the university agreed to be annexed, they can prevent the annexation. They have to agree to such a thing as a state entity.
Well, again, what's before the council tonight, or this afternoon, is not annexation. It's just sphere of influence. And as Ms. Carmen's explaining, this gives us an opportunity for having a cooperative relationship as the use of those properties go forward. Annexation could go forward from a sphere of influence, but not necessarily. If that issue were to ever come up, certainly that's an issue that we would fully vet out and provide any additional information. Certainly we've reached out to the university and would continue to do so. That's part of the reason for doing this, is having an ongoing dialogue with the university, make sure that whatever steps we take are something that they would be interested in and be supportive of.
Okay. I understand, but essentially in most communities, if you do a sphere, the ultimate expectation is that you would do an annexation. But I recognize this is not an annexation. It's merely the influence at this point in time.
I think that may be true for a number of jurisdictions, but I'm also aware of many jurisdictions which are particularly interested in open space between jurisdictions, and they want to identify and work cooperatively to maintain those green belts between jurisdictions along those lines. So not every sphere of influence is directed as a precursor to annexation. Quite frankly, I've seen it operate to be quite the opposite.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate the further explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Okay, one of my questions is why do this now? I realize it's because it's come up, mm-hmm. And we're being asked to take a look at it. And Councilmember Bennett asked the question about the advantages. Do we have any, going into a sphere of influence, do we have liabilities that come along with that? Are there any liabilities or nothing? Okay. I just, been trying to understand, because when I read this, the letter, one of the letters in here, it made perfect sense that they were saying a sphere of influence is like an engagement, and then with the anticipation of a marriage. So
let's take a 5-minute recess.
Okay.
Sorry. We're going to go ahead and get started. Mine's on. I hope they can hear me. Councilman Farr had to leave. He wasn't feeling. He's a little under the weather, so we're going to keep going without him. And I believe when I rudely interrupted Councilman Perotti, she was asking some questions. So we'll go back to you.
And I only have a few questions. I asked the liability issue. What are the downsides? Are there any downsides of entering into a, I'm trying to understand sphere of influence, so.
A sphere of influence, there usually are no downsides. Okay. It's in the example that you were talking about before the break, it's an indefinite engagement, and it can stay that way for years. It doesn't ever necessarily have to progress to annexation.
Mm-hmm. Stay at the engagement for a long engagement mm-hmm. and never a marriage?
Correct.
Okay. Have we sent out anything? We haven't heard from anybody. Have we, any of the neighbors?
Well,
or?
We heard from, the council heard from a significant number of individuals when the whole map was sent out as the council may be considering this, thinking that the Nolita issue would come up again.
Oh, okay.
But that is not, the council could choose to move in that direction. However, staff's just recommending looking at the west side of the future service areas.
Okay. I'm just trying to keep an open mind on this, but I'm just trying to figure out the compelling reasons to do this now, at this time when we have a lot on our plate as it is, within our own boundaries.
Just as a reminder, this is part of LAFCO's 5-year requirement to ask cities if they have changes in their spheres that they would like considered. So, really, they came to us as their task to do, and we felt that since this wasn't a conversation this council had yet, that we as staff couldn't give an answer for sure. So we thought it was important to bring to you. But as far as urgency goes, on our side, there really isn't anything particularly urgent.
And we could come back at some point?
If cities can make a request for a sphere of influence change outside of the normal 5-year, but the LAFCO is required to come to the cities every 5 years and ask if there are any changes.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Councilman Seves.
That is the case. They've gone through every city. We're the last one to respond, and because we haven't had this conversation. This is only a sphere of influence. It is an annexation. And the one thing that LAFCO's charged with is to not create islands. And when you look at future annexations, that's the main thing they look at, is not to create an island itself because of the services that are required to provide to that that area, sewer, water, you name it. So when you look at the map, which is not on the screen, we've got the islands of Area A, which I think is not what I think is a natural. I don't know why it wasn't included in the original sphere. And then Area E, the biggest concern is with especially Area E is having to say if there'd be a request for development in that area again as it was presented to us, I want to say 2008, when they came through with a big housing project for that whole golf course area. I think 8 is the year, but I could be wrong. So it seems to me that we should respond with a recommendation that LAFCO consider A and E at the very least, and possibly even D. But B and C, I'm not too concerned about yet, unless there's reason staff wants to include that also.
Is there any comment based on that?
Michael.
Go ahead. I was looking at you already saying go ahead, but I didn't say it. Go ahead. Come on, it's my first time.
No, that's okay. We all learn. We all get there. It's just it's something that comes, it'll come second nature.
Okay.
Trust me on that. Okay. I don't have a problem with sub-area A, and I don't have a problem with the D and E suggestion for the sphere. But I would like to make this statement so that if anyone's at home watching it or paying attention to it or the media reports on it, my colleague, Mr. Aceves, is correct in that we had this issue that staff had pursued, had actually started pursuing before we came on board, and it was continuing to be pursued after we were elected. And we made the commitment to the community that showed up here at the time that we would not further pursue any further movement towards the east, which essentially is east of Patterson, south of the freeway, or east of the creek, San Jose Creek, to the east of San Jose Creek, without that community coming to us making that request. So, and we agreed with that. We, you know, the council as a whole at that time, all of us spoke to the issue, and we all said that that was fine, and we were supportive of it being left in that fashion. So I want to make sure that everyone understands that's out there on that other side that we're not proposing for a minute to do anything further to the east. And this sub area A actually is a hole that's adjacent to our community, and we surround it, so it makes some sense. It should be looked at from a sphere standpoint. I fully get that. And the as it was better explained on the university side, I could see maybe where that coordination and tied in with our Sperling Preserve and the Santa Barbara Shores Park properties and all that tied in together. We've worked well together anyway, but this, if this enhances that, I'm all in favor of that. And certainly the golf course, that's an urban exercise. It's an urban environment. It's adjacent to us. There's no reason why we shouldn't have a sphere in that location. So I would be supportive of the A, D, and E suggestion from staff.
Any other questions before I start with my questions? I only have one or two, but go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, no, not a question, just a comment. I guess I'm feeling, I'm hesitating in... the one that I can see that I think would be a good idea would be Area D. I'm not so sure about E or A at this time. And basically, I'm just thinking, if it's not broken, why are we trying to fix it? And things seem to be going well. So I'm just not supportive of moving forward at this time.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a question of what is broken and what needs to be fixed. It's a sphere of influence, which is a legal term, which allows us to have greater input to what is planned for development there. So basically, we have to be consulted. Mm-hmm. And that's basically for D and E. And then A is literally a pocket within the city. And that's, like I said, LAFCO's mission is to not create pockets, but we did create one that here that needs to be fixed here. We're not annexing. We're not proposing annexation. We went to LAFCO before. It was an annexation question. It was not a sphere of influence question, and that's a big difference.
Then I do have one question on that. If we were to move forward saying we want these three parcels as incorporated in our sphere of influence, is it up to LAFCO to make that decision?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not a given. They could say yes, they could say no.
They said no last time, I believe.
But they said no with an annexation. We're not, and that's where the biggest concern is, and there was a lot of people that were misinformed that staff was directing us to annex property, which we were not, didn't think about, didn't consider. It was not on our not on our radar. When we went to LAFCO before, it was annexation.
Okay. Well, that makes me rethink my decision.
Okay. Just one or two quick questions then. If we were to expand our sphere of influence to these three areas, the next step, and I know we're not even discussing annexation, but that would still require a vote of those residents. If there are any residents in that area, they would have to want to vote to join
it's
us.
It's a very detailed process. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, LAFCO would have to grant a sphere change, and then from there, there's a lot of different steps that would have to happen before annexation could even be considered.
Okay, so because I know there was a lot of people, and we're not talking about the areas where those emails came from mostly.
Not at all.
And I would think, as far as, I don't know if we use the term urgency, but the reason to do this now would be, if we wait till somebody wants to do something there, it's probably too late.
Not necessarily. I mean, we're an adjacent city. We could have some influence.
Okay.
The only reason we're bringing it to you today is because we were asked to.
Because we were asked,
And if the council wanted to wait until even next year, we could always then write a letter to Paul Hood and LAFCO and say, we're ready now, we want to do this, and maybe there's other areas that when the council would like to look at. Those would require some CEQA work because these have already been looked at under CEQA as part of the general plan. So we would, I mean, it's entirely up to the council.
Okay. Well, I mean, overall, I think the logic of the reason we asked for these makes sense, and I don't see why we would wait anywhere. I was just kind of trying to understand the whole picture. So I would be fine with supporting Councilman Aceva's suggestion as well. And I don't know if we have further comment or if we just want to make a motion at this point.
I'd be love to make a motion, but I want to just make one final comment. And Ms. Carlin, what you just said right now is very important that we put it in the letter that this is already was contemplated in our general plan. Mm-hmm. We already did the CEQA review. Mm-hmm. There's no additional work that needs to be done other than for LAFCO to give its blessings on putting it in the sphere of influence. So, and that's critical because it was totally vetted out years ago. Mm-hmm. So I make the motion that we include those three areas in our recommendation to LAFCO for annexation approval.
Sphere of influence.
Sphere of influence. I was still thinking of annexation and sphere of influence.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. It's unanimous. Okay. Moving on. I guess we're almost done here. Council comments, standing committee reports. I'll start at the left with Councilman Bennett.
Well, I will speak to the most important issue that I was involved in for the last week. I was in Washington, D.C. on behalf of SBCAG, and it was a bit chilly in D.C., I can honestly say, as opposed to what we're experiencing here in Goleta, and that was interesting because I'm not real used to that kind of cold weather. But nonetheless, there were two full days of meetings with staff in D.C., with the Department of Transportation, and with the Rail Administration, subsections of all of those things. And everybody's pretty excited back in Washington because of the approval of a long-term transportation program, which up to now has been just continued from year to year. This is a program now that has 5 to 6 years to go forward. It's been funded for 3 years, but nonetheless, now we can begin to do some planning on the issues of our transportation infrastructure, and that includes rail as well as the roadways and bridges and so on and so forth. So it was an exciting time to be there because there's a much more upbeat feeling and attitude by those that are involved in these programs and have been for years. And so we'll have opportunities with SBCAG for the 101 project being the priority project to pursue funding opportunities. And we're going to work on trying to see what we can do to change. There's an element called the Freight National Highways, I believe, program that the 101 in this location is not designated for that. And that's another pot of money that communities have access to that we don't have access to. So we're looking and seeing if we might qualify for the rural designation. It was recommended to us to pursue that. And so that's something that the SBCAG staff will be working on. And that would be very beneficial for our county as a whole and for the Central Coast to get that type of a designation because it just expands the opportunity for funding. So I find that pretty exciting. So I just have to say that it looks like we're on the upside of some good times for us on transportation, which has been not so good for so long. So this is a real change in direction and one that was a bipartisan effort by the Congress and our Senate and with the President. So that in and of itself.
That's fairly unique these days.
It was incredibly important for all of us and for our entire nation and for everyone to come together on this. It's huge. It is really a big deal. So I'm incredibly optimistic that we're going to see some real positive projects go forward and to be supplemented in funding as a result of this working together in D.C. So we should all be upbeat, I think, at this point in time. That's my report.
Well, thank you for representing us over there and braving the weather. California boys like us do not handle that kind of weather, but thank you for doing that for us. So we'll move on to Councilwoman Perotti.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem. Thank you for doing that. Okay, my past few weeks have not been that exciting, but I did go to an event on February the 8th. It was the 30th Women in Sports Luncheon held at Earl Warren's Showgrounds, and there were just literally hundreds and hundreds of young women from high schools to colleges to junior colleges there being acknowledged for their participation in sports, all types of sports. And we had an audience rally by a personal trainer that you may have heard of. I'm sure a lot of people out there have, Jenny Shackle. She totally motivated all of us, got us all on our feet, and told us how we had to tell ourselves on a daily basis how awesome we are. So it was really great. It was a really great luncheon. They had a panel discussion by two young women who shared their story about starting in sports in high school and then going on to compete in universities. And then both of them are now attorneys, and how their sporting experience, they said it was because they're very competitive, they helped them become attorneys. So it was great to be there and to acknowledge that a lot of these women have never, because of Title IX, a lot of these women have never experienced what some women, some from my generation, we weren't encouraged to do sports. We just weren't encouraged. So with Title IX, you know, there was a law that said, no, women cannot be, you can't discriminate, and we're going to encourage women to participate. So that was, a lot of these women didn't have to go through that. February 11th, we had our Finance and Audit Committee meeting, which we discussed. And then February the 12th, I had a DEVRO meeting at DEVRO, and which was a great meeting, interviewing new board members. That's all I have.
Councilman Aceves?
Thank you. Just a couple things. Mr. Bennett, you have SBK tomorrow?
Thursday.
Okay. Hopefully the mayor will be feeling better on Thursday. If not, maybe the mayor pro tem get a hold of him and see if you can, or maybe Mr. Bennett could sit in for him. Thursday, in between SBK and APCD is a vote for the LAFCO, the mayor's selection committee for LAFCO for the city members. I'm up, and Mayor Richardson from Solvang's up. So all the mayors are getting together. So we should be represented there, and he can designate somebody to serve. If he can't go, then although you're the mayor pro tem, but since Mr. Bennett's already going to be there, he can just step down from the dais and vote and then continue on with APCD. Just a thought. So maybe staff keep that in mind as we get closer to Thursday and see how Mr. Farr is doing. Let's see. Thursday, I also have a finance committee for MTD. I kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier. Ridership is way down, but it's not just us. It's all through the state. And there's a lot of reasons for it, and, you know, we're trying to figure out what's particular for us. But everything from gas prices going down to the inconvenience of some of the routes. I mean, so we're trying to analyze everything. But in the meantime, we're going to go through a major budget reduction and find out where we can squeeze dollars so that we don't have to even start discussion on having a fare increase. So that's a big meeting for Thursday, and we'll see how that goes. And I think that's it.
Okay, thank you. Let me try and run through this fairly quickly so we can move on. But we did have our Finance and Audit Committee meeting, and we've already talked about that. There was a Southern California Edison meeting here in preparation for El Nino here at City Hall, and that was really informative, and I, you know, Edison is certainly doing its part to try and inform the public what they should be doing to prepare for El Nino, including the app they've put out there. There was an open house at Fairview Gardens, which was really informative, and they really seem to be turning their focus towards education as opposed to the actual farming, only because of the drought situation. So, but it was very interesting and well done. There was a grand opening for Pescucci. We got a new restaurant here in town, and that was a lot of fun. I wanted to thank the sheriff. I'm sure by now most people know about the news that about there was a bit of a threat, and we're not really sure all the details yet, but I know the sheriff's department was on top of that, and of course it gives me a little comfort knowing Officer Hendricks is always on campus there, and the rest of the sheriff's department was well aware of what was going on and reacting, so I want to thank them in advance for keeping our kids safe in our schools today. And lastly, we had an email about Armitos Park, and I'm guessing staff has already followed up on that, but I'd like to encourage them to. If we have an issue with that park, I think hopefully that's an email you got as well, Ms. Green, about some of the issues with that park and as far as cleanliness, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yes, I did receive that. I believe Councilmember Perotti forwarded that Thank one you. To me over the weekend, and also Councilmember Bennett. I appreciate, even if I get multiples of the same email, that's great. Just keep them coming. And that's been assigned to Vito Adamitis and Rosemary Gaglione. They're going to be working together on follow-up on that item.
Great. Thank you. And then lastly, it's not our park, but Goleta Beach Park. Friends of Goleta Beach have reached out to most of us about the issue. And, you know, it's all along the coast right now with the tide surges we're experiencing because of El Nino. But I'm sure what limited input we have with the county on that park, we're probably expressing. I went down there yesterday after the email, and, you know, those rocks are exposed all the way down to the edge of the parking lot. So I want to make sure the county continues to maintain it the way they're supposed to based on what the Cal Coastal Commission told us. And so whatever we can do to encourage the county to do that would be great. But that's all I have. So I guess now we ask for the city manager's report.
Yes, and today I just have one item. I wanted to remind the council and inform the public that on the 27th...
Man, she's got a lot of horsepower.
I know. Did you hear that? My goodness. If you can't hear that at home, it's pretty loud. But anyway, go ahead.
On the 27th of this month, we will have a full-day zoning ordinance workshop. The public and any interested parties are welcome to come, and that's... coming up next week. So please mark your calendars for that. Otherwise, that's all I had.
Okay. City Attorney, do you have a report?
No, I do not.
Okay. So in that case, can you read it? We're having a closed session, so can you read us into closed session?
Yes, there is a need for the City Council to meet in closed session this afternoon on two items, conference with legal counsel pursuant to Section 54956.9D with regard to potential initiation of one matter. Also, conference with a real property negotiator pursuant to Section 54956.8 with regard to property at 5590 Hollister Avenue. No reportable action is anticipated.
Okay. With that, I guess I'll just wish Mayor Farr good health. Hopefully he's feeling better. And we'll adjourn to closed session. He's feeling better.